The VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 525, recorded on January 16th, 2019.
The 25th edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and 358th episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am TJ Denzer.
I am Scott Durr.
I am Jonah Falcon.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry.
Well, not really, not today. So finally we have a podcast after 3 weeks of a lot of fluffling about. I won't get into the technical issues, just that I'm finally able to record a podcast. And I have my desktop with me. So, this week we're not going to do any news, although there's some really big news that have been going on lately. There's some really shocking news.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. I'm not even thinking of Star Control Origins with that legal thing, which is making everybody realize, you know, it might be good to have physical media sometimes.
Oh, definitely.
Because what was the name of that game again? A two-human situation in which all the copies of the game had to be destroyed. All the physical copies of the game had to be destroyed. But it's close. I mean, because of this legal thing, you cannot buy it anymore. Now, you can download it if you already own it, but you cannot get it new, at least until it's resolved.
Yeah.
And I will say that I am now a press member for Epic's Game Store, which means right now, 40% of the store is free to me, and soon it'll be 100%.
Nice.
Sweet.
So, I mean, if I wanted to, I could play the Final Dead Walking season. I don't want to. Because I don't have enough of a save file for that game, so why would I bother? I've given up on The Walking Dead. I've straight up given up on it. And I also did not play No Man's Sky during the entire time I had to deal with this stuff. I just sent it back to Gamefly, so it'll just have to remain a mystery for now. No, No Man's Sky.
Some mysteries are better left unsolved.
Yeah.
That's true.
But what have you been playing, Scott?
I've been playing Ni No Kuni 2. Okay. It's an RPG that came out by Studio Ghibli, I believe.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later.
Okay. And it is an RPG game that has action based battles, and
yeah, we'll talk about it later.
Oh, okay, sorry, I misunderstood.
Yeah, well, how about you, TJ? What have you been playing?
I've been playing quite a few things. I'm coming to the end of Horizon Zero Dawn.
Okay.
And holy hell, the third act of that game is ridiculous.
Oh no! Yes,
I do.
You say it's ridiculous. Other people say it's incredibly stupid.
Really? Well, yeah. Other people are incredibly stupid because it's. I feel like it was quite a swerve.
Only if you had blindfolds on. How could you not tell what was going on in the first two thirds of the game? Seriously.
No, I had an inkling, but like to the extent that it was talking about, it was
yeah, it's the same kind of ending that's shat out by M. Night Shyamalan.
Nah.
Shyamalan. Yeah. It's crap.
You're crap, Jonah. It's when it comes together, it comes together in a interesting way. Like the way that everything starts to not just like the obvious things that have been sort of been hinted at throughout the game, but like the things that actually do have impact.
I don't think you should be playing Shadow of the Colossus again. What is that noise? TJ?
No, that's on Scott's side.
Yeah.
So it's a piece of plastic.
So, as I just said, I think you should be playing Shadow of the Colossus again.
I enjoy Horizon a lot. It's had a story that's been... I mean, I'm not going to say it's the most perfect story, but I will say that it's been more intriguing than most other open world games I've played. Like, taking on all the robots in the game was fun because every one of them has some sort of strategy to them, and there's a super huge arsenal in the game to deal with them. Mm-hmm. And so combat only really gets boring to me when it's just humans, because humans are just, like, always the same.
No.
I mean, just shoot them in the head with an arrow and that's that. But the robotic enemies in the game it was always really cool to find a new one and figure out how to take it down. And then, like,
Shadow of the Colossus.
And then the story that goes with that is, I mean, at the very worst, it's passable, but there is some interesting stuff in there. I like the characters. I like the way the narrative moves. And ultimately, I think I'm going to enjoy the ending on that game because I've worked for it. I've also been playing Red Dead Redemption 2. And
okay. Oh.
I do got to say.
How far are you into it?
I got to where, like, shortly after the whole caravan moves to Horseshoe Outlook.
Okay. Has anybody sneezed in your face with tuberculosis yet?
Nope. Okay. Thankfully. right now I'm hunting down the gunslingers for a stranger.
Oh.
And, you know, I do always enjoy how much freedom Red Dead Redemption 2 gives you. That said, I do gotta say, I am not a fan of the fact that there is no fast travel in the game.
Yeah, and you have to buy that, and even then, it's not exactly... But we're gonna get into that later. We can't really get into these games, because we're gonna be discussing a bunch of them anyway.
Mm-hmm. But outside that, yeah, those are the two big ones that have been taking up my time.
So anyways, the format of the show is going to be different. We're not going to be talking about news. We're just going to be talking about all the games that we thought were the best that we played this year. And then a bunch of games which we might have forgotten or were not quite good enough for the list. So we're going to start it off because here's the thing. Of all the games that were listed, only one game had more than one person mention it. And that was you and Scott. And I'm going to wait until this is over. Okay, you know what? Just wait. Okay. So, we're going to mention the one game that TJ and Scott both mentioned, and that's Monster Hunter World.
Yeah, I mean, like, it was probably, in my memory of 2018, the most beautiful game I played. And hands down, that's kind of what put it at the top of my list. Like, there are other games that are very pretty. There are games that are stylistic, and there are games that that do quirky things that are neat. But Monster Hunter World was absolutely drop-dead beautiful. Like, the environments were really super beautiful and diverse. The weapons were cool as hell, and the monsters were so damn well done as far as, like, their details and what they do. So, like, as far as, like, just, like, absolute spectacle, it had to be Monster Hunter World for me.
It was a very beautiful game, but for me, it kind of ends there. You know, you have this beautifully well-done world, this huge map that you can explore, and you can do all sorts of hunts and, you know, hunt down all these monsters. And it's really, you know, the tutorial is very long.
Well, I hope that you're hunting monsters in a game called Monster Hunter.
Yeah, I know. But for me, I just couldn't feel hooked in, and I didn't really see the story worth following to continue with the game. My character felt like it was less of a blank slate and, like, you're not even really there. I feel like I'm just watching everybody else do stuff, and I just didn't.
But why did you put this one in your favorite games of 2018 then?
Well, it does deserve to be mentioned, and it was a fun game. It's not my favorite, but it is a fun game. Like DJ said, it was beautiful. Mechanics were great. You get to, work on your gear, and you have a little kitty sidekick. I mean, that gets points right there, having a cat sidekick. I mean, come on. So it was a fun game. It just wasn't my favorite game of 2018, is all I'm saying.
Having a cat sidekick was the only thing I liked about that game, and the controls, no. You two might be used to the controls in Monster Hunter World, but I come from a world where gamepads are supposed to be used in a certain way, and Monster Hunter World just says, fuck you, you're going to do it my way. Even though it makes no sense, you know?
Yeah, Monster Hunter's controls and like, the displays have always been counterintuitive. It was, like, clearly a game that was built for a PC, but it's rarely ever been on PC.
Only once been on PC. Now. Uh-huh. Maybe in Japan? I mean, you have to check, but I don't think it's been on PC in Japan either, where they call it Mega Drive? No, that's Sega.
Yeah.
So you end up with all these menus within menus and cycling things, and just like it's so.
There were shortcuts to like save certain outloads of items and commands, but it's not very intuitive, like you said. So you
Let me ask you a question. Have you guys played the handheld version of Monster Hunter?
No.
Yes.
Okay. Let me ask. Then how do the controls compare with that?
It's similar. I mean, it's not too far different as far as the way you access like hotkey items and then access deeper menus. It's Monster Hunter has always kind of been that way, where like it's just counterintuitive as far as like the interface and the actual controlling of it.
Well, let me ask you, when did you first play a Monster Hunter game? Which one was it?
The first one I ever played was Monster Hunter Generations. It was Monster Hunter 3 Ultimate on 3DS, which was a port over of another one.
How about you, Scott?
I guess I haven't played any other Monster Hunter game, just the Monster Hunter World.
Okay.
But I have seen videos
So let me ask you a question. Scott, you played it on PC, right? Were you just waiting for it to come out on PC?
I played it on the PlayStation. Got it for me.
Because there were so many people who were so excited about it finally coming to PC.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I don't know how the PC port has gone, but usually PC ports go pretty well, I think.
Well, I'm thinking about the controls. I mean, doing a mouse and keyboard, if anybody's played the PC version of Monster Hunter World on a PC, let us know how the PC keyboard worked with it.
Wasn't one of your issues with it was just that everything feels clumsy as far as your movements and attacks and everything?
No, I just felt like I was just pissing up a rope trying to play the game. It's sort of like, okay, you did all this, but guess what? When you play Far Cry Primal, it's sort of like Far Cry Primal, except to the nth degree, where you do this against the boss monster and then, oh, he runs away. Okay, well, guess what? You're going to have to do this now. You know, it's sort of like multi-stage stuff that I really want a hunting game that's not Cabela's, but sort of like a Cabela's for Monsters, which is not too complicated, but it takes a lot of work to find the really good ones. But not, you have to capture this much of A and this much of, pseudo-MMO shit,
I'm going to share a secret with y'all, and it's another reason that this game is on my Game of the Year list. It's not about the monsters. It's not about the story. The story is garbage.
The stories about giant tar monsters aren't good?
No. It's all about the main character of the game, the main protagonist, which is not you or any of your friends. It's Muscular Chef. it's about getting all the ingredients to bring back to that kick-ass little chef cat so you can watch him and his little cat buddies cook.
I was hoping for different animations for different meals, but it's just one, I guess.
I just want one. If there's an MMO in which you had a cat companion, like in Monster Hunter World, I'd be sold.
Oh, no, Scott. There are different animations depending on what you cook and what ingredients you use.
Okay. You just seem to constantly just be putting that little sprig on a fish, like, over and over again.
Well, what else do you need to put on a fish?
I mean, like, I just wanted them to cook a steak once,
He does. Later in the game, you get like a turret. He makes a big old giant bird, and he puts the little cap on his feet.
Okay.
And
is that a steak? Steak is from a bovine animal.
He also does a steak, I think, at some point.
Yeah, from one of the monsters that are nothing like cows, I'm pretty sure.
But Meowskular Chef is character of the year, easily. Best character arc, best story.
So we're going to talk about Red Dead Redemption 2, my game, and basically my game of the year. And here's the thing. I had issues with it, and I think my saying Red Dead Redemption 2 is the best game of the year for me is sort of like an indictment on 2018, because there were so many disappointments this year. I mean, I had a lot of high hopes for Call of Cthulhu. I had a lot of high hopes for Vampyr. I had a lot of high hopes for Far Cry 5. All these AAA games came out, and they were just... eh.
And then there's Fallout 76, of course.
Yeah, we'll get to that later. But on the other hand, it wasn't a disappointment because I knew it was going to be shit. All year, I was telling you to, it's going to be shit. And you were giving me excuses why it wasn't going to be shit. Now, granted, most of the reasons why I thought it was going to be shit was because of griefing. And except for one incredibly racist, white supremacist incident, I think we talked about it already.
Yeah.
There's no griefing because the game is too boring to be griefed in. Being griefed is actually a welcome respite. It's like, thank you, something's happening. Someone actually gave two shits to kill me. Thank you for killing me.
They should have implemented ways to control that kind of thing, and evidently they didn't. And I don't know why, because they had experience having the Elder Scrolls MMO game. So it was really sloppy.
I think it's just they made the game so boring. That's how they worked with griefing. So that griefing was actually something that was good. Anyways, back to Red Dead Redemption 2. So the main problem I had with Red Dead Redemption 2, and I talked about this before on the podcast, it's just too big. It's just too big. I mean, to get from one place to the other, it takes hours, you know. And while it is one of the most beautiful games you'll ever see, and it's one of those games in which if you see it in the distance, guess what? You can get to it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you know why the opening starts with a snowstorm, a blizzard, TJ?
Mm-hmm.
So that you can see the realistic snow prints that you make and how they stay there the entire time. That's them bragging. Look what we can do.
Yeah, it's impressive, you know? To say the least.
But... see, here's the difference between Red Dead Redemption 2. The real difference between Red Dead Redemption 2 and Red Dead Redemption is that I never really had a connection with most of the characters.
Really?
Yeah, and especially the character that you play, you know.
You don't like Arthur Morgan?
No. One thing, he has a generic voice that you expect from a side character.
Yeah, he does kind of have that her feller tarnation.
I mean, I did like setting him on the good path. So, like I did with John in the first game, you know, because here's this guy who's obviously a henchman and a villain, you know, and he'd be the big heavy in any other game if you weren't playing him. And seeing him try to be a good person was actually kind of rewarding. But I did not like, I mean, I just wanted to kick Arthur, not Arthur, I just wanted to kick our boss in the nuts, because he's obviously going off the deep end and no one cares.
Yeah, and I think that's, like, seeing the way Dutch acts makes... or there's another particular character that I actually find myself aligned with a lot and actually feel for is Hosea, because he's trying so fucking hard, and he just can't get through.
Yeah, I also really, really, really like Kieran. Kieran is the guy from that gang that you capture, and he's actually threatened with having the... his ball snipped off by a red hot poker, you know, and he stays with the gang, and he no one ever trusts him, you know, and I really liked his character. You know, I don't like what happens to him, but I like his character.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to spoil too much there.
Sure.
But I'm going to tell you something. This game does not like to do plot twists. So, the blonde, oh geez, what is his name again? Oh, God. Oh, fuck. What is his name?
The blonde character you play as?
Micah. Wait. Micah. Micah.
Okay.
Micah, the blonde psychotic character?
Micah's the worst.
Guess what? And here's a minor spoiler for you. He never improves.
Of course he doesn't.
I think he appears in Red Dead Redemption 2, which is why he has to remain that way.
I hate him. I hate him so very much.
Yeah.
I hate that you're required to be saddled with him sometimes.
Yeah, and here's the thing. Anybody with half a brain would have kicked his fucking ass out. He is so destructive. He is... And I can't say anything. Although, here's the thing. I do find myself liking Uncle a lot, because he's such a lazy bastard.
Mm-hmm. Unabashedly so.
Yeah, and also, I really like something that you did not get from Red Dead Redemption, but you finally get a lot more insights into Abigail, who is John Marston's wife, because she spends most of Red Dead Redemption kidnapped, right? Mm-hmm. But here, you get to see the evolution of that relationship, you know? you actually see, oh, this is why they're so attracted, you know? She has an undying loyalty, but she doesn't put up with any shit, and she doesn't put up with John's shit either, you know? And, you know, a lot of the characters you meet in Red Dead Redemption are really compelling. The only thing is that I just want to fucking kick Dutch in the ass. You know, he is going off the deep end, and there's nothing you can do about it. And all of his decisions are bad. All of them. It's like, well, you know, the reason why he's your boss is because he was your boss by the end of Red Dead Redemption. So guess what? And that's the other thing we have to talk about, is that if you played Red Dead Redemption, you don't have to worry about certain characters because you know they're going to be alive in Red Dead Redemption. You don't have to worry about John. You don't have to worry about Abigail. You don't have to worry about Jack. You don't have to worry about Sadie. Oh, Sadie is one of my favorite characters too. You rescue her from, I don't know if she was she raped in the beginning, or was she just had her husband killed?
Her family was killed.
Right. So she becomes Annie Oakley. She starts wearing pants. She starts being a gunfighter. And I really like her character, you know, and she's one of the unambiguously good guys in the entire thing.
Mm-hmm.
I also like Charles, who is the Native American guy. And you meet him in Red Dead Redemption, so you know he's going to live. That entire story arc with the tribe is just depressing. You haven't gotten to it yet, but it's still depressing. The other thing is that Agent Milton, you also want to shoot dead. He's the one who has Agent Ross as his assistant, and everything he does is just... I don't care how crooked the FBI was at the turn of the century, there is no fucking way that they would have been allowed to do that, what they do in this. I mean, you could sort of get that they could get away with it in Red Dead Redemption. You know, because they're hunting a fugitive, and well, he fired on us, you know. But in this, he's just, it's, you know, I will say this: Colmel Driscoll gets what he deserves. I'll leave it at that. Anyways, but like I said, the problem I had with Red Dead Redemption is it's just too big, and you know, I would have preferred a tighter, most focused story in a certain area. And when you get into the prologue, the big area becomes even more big, because all of a sudden you have access to everything that was in Red Dead Redemption. Because until you get to the epilogue, you can't go to Blackwater, right? And you can't go to Mexico, unfortunately. I'm willing to bet you that'll be DLC at some point, going to Mexico. But everywhere else you can go. And the map is friggin' huge. But at that point, the epilogue, it's basically an open world game, and you just go around doing stuff and discovering stuff and looking on. It becomes Breath of the Wild, you know. It's funny because before the epilogue, I'm pretty sure you noticed this. You find yourself railroading yourself basically on the main plot. I mean, you have the side quests, but it's sort of like you just want to get the main quest over with, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, don't you feel that you're being you're railroading yourself onto the main quest?
In Red Dead Redemption
2, the sequel, the one we're talking about.
No, you know, like Maybe it focuses in a little bit more later on. But right now, I actually don't have any idea where, outside of seeing like the names of,
yeah, well, that's the main quest, yeah.
Important people. I don't really feel like I'm being pushed towards them at all.
I felt like I was being pushed towards it, and I don't think it's because I wanted to get the main story over with. I just felt everything else was not that interesting. I mean, it's odd. In Red Dead Redemption, I didn't mind flower picking and doing all the other minor stuff. In this, no, you know.
Oh well. That I don't care about because I don't have time for that shit anymore.
I will say this. The legendary animals are surprisingly easy to get.
Yeah, I'll probably do the hunting stuff, but collecting herbs, that just like was never my jam.
I will say this, though. Cooking in this game is really important. I didn't discover that until I was like 2/3 through the game. But once you find the appropriate herbs that maybe, say, take your bison meat... And not only does it help your health, but if you put a certain type of herb on it, it restores your dead eye. You know, so I found that doing that, and it's not that common. You just go to make a campfire and just add it, right? So at least picking herbs actually has a purpose here and actually a good one. But here's the other thing about Red Dead Redemption, which I liked and didn't like at the same time. Combat is so easy. It is a snap, especially even if you have the worst dead eye. I never felt like I was in any danger. If I ever died, it was my fault. It was never because the game was hard.
Yeah, I got shot to death one time, and after that, like I just sort of figured it out. There are settings where you can pretty much turn off aim assist and all that jazz, but it really is just like. Zero in, move your cursor up just a smidge, and shoot him in the head.
And also, at a certain point, I don't know if you got to it yet, the game just dumps thousands of dollars on you, and you can afford everything. It's sort of like, yeah, we just want you to do what you want to do, so here's the money, enjoy. And it does it twice.
Yeah, well, it's more of a climb in the first game, and it really... If that's the case, then that's a little bit unfortunate.
I got a volcanic pistol, and I bought another one, and I just made one of all gold and the other one of all silver, and that was my if the gold one won't get you, the silver one will sort of thing.
you don't get the straight up semi-automatic pistol in the first game until you get to Blackwater and like the last few chapters of the game, and it's by far so much better than every other pistol that it feels so good when you finally get it.
Yeah, and this you get it right away. I mean,
and that's
and you also get the really good sniper rifle really, really fast, and you know, I do like using the bow and arrow. And I enjoy doing it for hunting because you almost always, you know, you get a better chance of getting a good pelt if you use the bow and arrow.
Mm-hmm.
And the critter gun is actually effective. Sometimes you'll forget. Here's the thing, folks. You have to put the guns in your horse or else they're not going to be available to you.
Right.
So once but the critter gun, you know, is a good last chance thing. You know, it's like, oh shit, I got to get out of this. Oh, I'll use the critter gun. Just wait until that bear attacks you, though. Anyways, so we're going to move on to the next game, and finally TJ is going to talk about God of War and how great it is. I'm going to give you a little secret after playing it. The combat actually sucks. I know you love, love, love the story, but the combat is subpar, and I'm not even comparing it to God of War, other God of War games. I'm talking about just period. I mean... It was shocking to me how bad the combat... Well, not bad, but not good either. But I know you don't care about that. You just cared about Data Fort.
Yeah, I mean, it's entirely different. It's super-duper different from everything that came before it. And it's really strange to see a franchise this established reinvent itself in a way that it did here. Like, yeah. To where it's like, it's not about the blood, it's not about this, it's not about the destroying everything around you, like, with reckless abandon. It really is, what's the word for it?
I'm going to stop you right now, because I'm really getting sick of this genre, and it's the hairy dad game.
What other Harry Dad games are there besides Dad of War?
Well, let's see. The Last of Us is a Harry Dad game. There's other games in which you play a father who's protecting a daughter, and he always has a mustache and beard. Because you know why there are so many Harry Dad games out there? Because all the developers are becoming Harry Dads.
You know, I looked up the developers of God of War, and Santa I couldn't Monica confirm Studio. If yeah. any of them were fathers.
Actually... Anyway, but we have all these Harry Dad games, you know, and as Yahtzee Croshaw said, where are the Harry Mom games? And with your mother protecting their kid, you know?
Well, hopefully that'll be Horizon Zero Dawn 2.
So anyways, God of War, at least, you know, this is a game that Sony said, you better make it look fucking pretty. you better make it use every single bit of the PS4 or else.
They kind of did. Like, some of the worlds are really interesting. The when you start traveling between the realms, like, some of them – I'm not going to say that they caught my attention the way that Monster Hunter World did, but
– I really don't get that. To me, Monster Hunter World was just an assault of leaves and things. I don't know what you were looking at. Maybe I didn't get far enough into the game, but to me it was just like being in Return of the Jedi in the forest moon of Endor.
There were different areas. There was some mud flats. There was some more rocky areas.
I doubt it, but you're going on about how it looked, and I just didn't see it. But then again, I didn't get too far in the game.
Yeah, you didn't get that far. And like the more you – it's like peeling back an onion. The more you get in there, the more it reveals.
Yes,
and...
but onions make you cry, and I didn't want to cry. Getting back to God of War. So it looked pretty. It looked pretty.
Yeah, it did look pretty. And I mean, like, they really – the parts where there was violence, they were like, well, we better do it right. So you rip the jaw off of a werewolf and just pull it down his chest.
That's their favorite move in that game, just ripping off someone's jaw. You know, they need Duke Nukem in that game instead. If they're going to – you know, just have them, you know, rip the testicles off someone – and then boot it through field goal posts.
And I mean, like, I'm going to disagree with you on the combat. It wasn't bad. It was methodic. And that's not what God of War is about. Like, you can't hack and slash your way through God of War. It's simply impossible.
But that's the entire point. That's why God of War is an entire genre. I mean, what's it called? You know, things are called God of War clones.
And that's why I'm saying that God of War 4 is not... It's just not the it's almost to the point where if it wasn't called God of War, it could be called anything else, and you wouldn't know that it had anything to do with God of War because it doesn't feel the same at all.
Maybe it should have been a different thing because I mean it's such a divorce from the previous series.
But like it makes sense to me because at the end of God of War 3, you had a Kratos who finally. Realized he can't keep killing everything that stands between him and his goals. And it only ends when he stops. And so God of War 4 is sort of that – I don't want to sound corny and say healing journey, but it is kind of that.
Where, and it's sort of an apology for God of War 2 and 3. Bros before hoes. By the way, Yakuza 6 was another Harry Dad game.
Yakuza the series is that, but it's also good.
No, but in Yakuza 6, he was given a baby to deal with, and he had to become a Harry Dad game.
Yeah, but he's suave, so that's fine.
Oh, Kira... I forgot how to say his name. Kira Yak... Oh, damn it. Oh, boy. I'm just like... I'm gonna stumble over this, aren't I?
He's in the Yakuza. Kiryu.
What? Kiryu. Yeah. Well, anyways, I don't know. He's just as Yahtzee calls him, a serious-faced man with a brick for a face who likes disco-stomping people.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. For honor and justice. But,
I mean, the problem I have with God of War is that they mischaracterize all the Norse gods. I mean, Heimdall is not evil, assholes. Near there's Baldur. As a matter of fact, Baldur is basically Christianity being infused into Norse mythology because he's supposed to be the only one alive after Ragnarok, and he's there with two people in a garden and all that stuff, and he's basically Jesus.
Didn't Loki get him killed with a goddamn it, with that one plant?
Baldur was killed by Hemlock because Loki decided he wanted to be a dick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the whole point of God of War is
it wasn't Hemlock, it was Mistletoe.
But the whole point of God of War has always been that, like, don't trust gods because they don't care.
No, that's what first... here's the thing. The first God of War was about him realizing that all the violence he did was pointless and nothing changed.
Honestly,
Two and three were about, let's debase women.
I've never been into the God of War because he just feels like Cain, only just not a vampire.
Here's the thing. Kratos in 2 and 3 is just evil and unrepentant and an asshole.
Yeah, that's Cain.
I don't like bro dudes, you know, and Kratos is their jack-off fantasy of what is a guy. Straight bro dudes. I just want to go away.
But the underlying theme has always been gods don't care.
No, Kratos doesn't care.
No, the gods don't care.
No, Kratos doesn't care. He kills innocent people just to pass a puzzle. Are you fucking kidding?
Well, sure.
No, but also gods don't care. No, yeah, and here's the thing.
Are you going to sit there and tell me that Zeus is like, I'm just looking after everybody?
No one has any sympathy for Kratos in 2 and 3, period, end of story.
Sure, but they also don't have sympathy for anyone else.
Oh, I have sympathy for everybody else than Kratos.
Even the Titans are even admit to just using Kratos to get at the gods, and then they try to kill him, and then he kills them back.
Whatever, I don't care. I really don't care. Kratos can eat a dick. I don't care if he has some sperm offspring, you know, I don't care.
Wow.
That's okay. I don't care either that you don't care, but I do care.
So
the thing about God of War 4 is that...
Well, actually, it's not God of War 4, though. They decided to do the entire reboot thing and just call it God of War.
Sure, but to keep confusion, I'm just going to call it God of War 4.
I know, I'm just saying, there's a trope I really hate. Stop with the fucking rebooting.
You hate every single thing about this.
No, this has nothing to do with God of War. This has to do with everything. Fucking call it Prey 2 if you want to call it Prey 2. Don't call it Prey. Okay? You know, every time something comes to a new console or anything like that, they feel this need not to... I don't understand how they were able to bring Halo to the Xbox 360 and they didn't call it Halo... The new thing... No, they actually called it Halo 3, which I was shocked by. Now, here's the thing. They're calling Halo 6 in Halo Infinite, and they specifically said it was going to be 6 without actually being called 6. I'm willing to bet you by the time it's released in 2020, they're going to call it Halo 6 Infinite. I'm just saying, stop, you know, with Hitman Blood Money. When did it come out? Did it come out before 1? Did it come out before 2? Anyways, you were saying about God of Dead.
God of War. I mean, I like it. I like it a lot, and I'm not alone in that.
It was the Game Awards Game of the Year.
It was the Game of the Year.
But
the
here's
Game
the thing:
Awards.
They also gave Best Writing to fucking David Cage and Detroit. Was it one of the worst written games? You can't really trust those assholes.
You know, but they're not alone. I'm not alone.
The Detroit game.
Detroit, but they're not something, something.
But they're not alone, and I'm not alone, and I know a lot of people that
God of War. I'm not saying that, but here's the thing. The main thing about God of War to me was that it did not have God of War combat. It was just not God of War, and the combat was mediocre at best. And
that's
the
wrong.
There's a
reason. I mean, it's mediocre to you, but it's...
Oh, come on.
No.
You played the other God of Wars.
Yeah, but I didn't approach it as if I was playing the other God of Wars because
it's
I've already
God of
said
War.
Already
Why did you approach
that this
it?
Is.
But they're telling you to approach it like a God of War because it's called God of War.
No, I'm approaching it the way it is, which is its own thing.
But it's a God of War
obviously,
game.
And obviously, TJ was invested in the story and wanted to see where they were going.
If they released Civilization VII and it was completely in real time, would you say, "Oh, that's a Civilization game"?
Well, sure, but I'm saying from the beginning. I said from the very, very beginning of my argument here, God of War.
It's not that different, Jonah.
God of War here is not meant to be approached the way that the other ones were. It was never meant to be that way.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I mean, it's not just yeah, sure. That's the way it is. I mean, if you try to swing through everything, you're going to die. If you don't rely on Atreus, then you lose half your then you don't have half your arsenal there.
There's a new God Hand game coming out, right?
Right. Okay.
There's a new God Hand game. At least that will give people their satisfaction of just going batshit crazy.
Okay, but fuck those people. If they came into this expecting Bro Dude McSlaughter, then they...
No, they came in expecting God of War combat.
McSlaughter. Jonah, when you were using that metaphor, or not metaphor, but that... basically, the way God of War has gone to God of War 4 is like when Civilization went from square tiles and to one
hexes?
Unit per tile and hexes. It was different, but not so different that it was a different genre. It still is in the same genre of games. It's just a little bit different on how you implement it, but it's still the same genre.
So, Scott, now everybody who's been listening to this podcast, even a little bit, knows what game that Scott's been was playing for weeks and weeks and weeks. So let me ask you a question, Scott. Was Dragon Quest XI your game of the year?
You know, it's really difficult to pick a game of the year when so many of them were good, but I really do want to call that one the game of the year because it was such a good Dragon's Quest. It brought out, you know, you were allowed to see animated monster fights because, like, the past seven or so, it was always still action fights. So now you can actually see the actions when they attack. And the story was really good.
Yeah, I was about to say, you know, I wasn't that enthralled with the combat. I mean, the combat to me was bog standard, but the exploration and finding stuff and talking to people and the music was actually what sold me on Dragon Quest XI.
Yeah, the music was very good, and I liked the cell shading was good. I think they had some computer-generated parts as well combined with it.
Well, the entire game is computer-generated.
Yeah.
You mean pre-rendered cutscenes. I don't remember. I didn't play enough of it to remember that. But I wouldn't be surprised if there was. I mean, we talked about this in the last podcast, how much work they put into it, getting with the localization, you know, these people speak French. And these people talk in all haikus, and these people all rhyme, you know, and all that stuff.
I liked the item creation. We had the little fun anvil, and it was actually kind of strategic. Yeah, it was like a puzzle. How to figure out how to get the most best equipment with your hammer blows and
sort of reminds me of Fable, actually.
I can see that. And I liked the characters and the story was good. And you have that whole challenge after you beat the first final boss. You have a whole section of the game where you can like redo past events to get an even better ending. But you have to fight an even harder boss and harder mini bosses, and it was quite challenging.
I wonder if that was imagine if they made Dragon Quest Majora's Mask. The thing about Dragon Quest XI, though, I think it was the prettiest game that was released this year, and I think it was the art style, basically, you know. I mean, Breath of the Wild was okay in terms of art. You know, I know a lot of people, but I'm going to tell you, Dragon Quest XI made Breath of the Wild look bad in comparison. Because here's the thing, I don't see many games being able to do this, but Dragon Quest XI knows how to use color.
Yeah,
you know?
Definitely. It was a lot more vibrant, I think. You're right.
Vibrant, but not clashing and not gaudy. You know, it was naturally. It's not like someone took the saturation and made it go full, you know. It's just they knew how to use the color to tell a story, you know, just the graphics. And, you know, I mean, they talk about the localization and all that and the music and the sound, but, you know, there's something to be said about not having a filter on everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the nice part about the Dragon's Quest was the whole, you just felt like you were playing... like they really were incorporating the whole RPG elements from the past, you know, letting you explore the world parts at a time as you unlock certain things to get farther. You get your ship, you're allowed to sail across the oceans, and then you get a like this harp thing that allows you to teleport.
Let me ask you a question. Where did you play it? Did you play it on PC or did you play it on console?
Computer. Yeah, okay. PC.
Because one of the things you'll notice as a running thing about 2018 is a lot of the games have been coming out on PC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's been really awesome.
Yeah. So we're going to move back to me. And one game that people forget was released in 2018 was the expansion to Civilization VI Rise and Fall. And just like Civilization V, the second expansion just made it perfect. You know, and I think that's the thing with Civilization. Ever since Civilization IV, it takes two expansions to make the game perfect.
I disagree a little bit. Only in the way that like Civilization IV and V, there were drastically missing things that needed to be fixed. Civilization VI didn't feel incomplete at its core. Rise and Fall just made it better.
Oh, I made a mistake, actually. Civilization Rise and Fall was actually the first expansion. The second expansion is coming out in a month.
Gathering Storm.
Yeah, and that...
But, probably the most cliché title used.
Really? Gathering Storm? Yeah. You consider that a cliché title?
Winston Churchill wrote his book, Gathering Storm. Brandon Sanderson wrote his book, Jordan's book, Gathering Storm.
Yeah, but for a video game?
Well, not for video game, but for... Mm-hmm. You know, just used in general. It's been overused.
By the way, we have to talk briefly about the two civs that were shown off. Once was Mansa Musa, and if you want a summary of what that civ does, the Mali, just think about Goldmember. I love
money.
Gold. No, I love gold. Everything they do gives them gold.
Pretty much.
Yeah,
and then for the next one is a very mannish woman. I forgot her name. Damn it! But
the Swede, but she's for the Swedes.
Yeah, the Swedish. And basically, what their thing is, we're the culture gods. We're the culture gods, and we're also the diplomacy gods. you know, everything they do gets some culture and it gets some diplomacy. And one of the things about it, which is, you know, all these little tweaks, you know, these gameplay tweaks, if the Swedes are in the game, suddenly you can compete for the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, you know,
if the Swedes
that.
Are not in the game, you don't have it. But if the Swedes are in the game, you can compete for the Nobel Prize.
That's neat. Like, that perfectly lays out what I'm talking about. Civilizations, and this isn't knocking the game at all. It's more commentary on the series itself, is that Civilization VI... is the first Civilization game that I can remember where just like at its core, at its foundation, it was good. It was already good.
But here's
what the expansions have done is made it better in interesting and unique ways.
But you have to understand something about Civ 6. It's basically a fan game. Everybody behind the making of Civilization 6 have been longtime Civilization fans. So it's sort of like people from Apolloden decided to make – got their hands on Civilization – and have all done, wouldn't it be cool if... ...
Mm-hmm.
Like the Polynesians, you know? They start in the water. Wouldn't it be cool if you had to find your land, you know?
Wouldn't it be cool if Tundra was usable for somebody?
Yes. And it's usable for the Swedes as well.
Yeah, actually, Swedes get a bonus from having each type of terrain.
Right, so you might as well get some Tundra in there, get a bonus.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, wouldn't it be nice if you can just have, what's it called, have mountain tunnels? So, yeah. But, you know, let's get back to Rise and Fall. Rise and Fall was really good. And it added a lot of gameplay elements. And here's the thing, Civilization VI on its own, it was okay, but it wasn't really holding my attention as much, you know. And when Rise and Fall came out, it's like, yeah, it was more like it, and they introducing for one thing the Golden Ages, or was that already in Civ?
That was in Civilization V.
No, and Golden Ages and Dark Ages and all that. I don't think it was in Civilization.
Oh, the Dark Age thing.
Golden Ages.
I mean, no. Here's the thing: you always had the "We love the President," you know, celebrations.
Well, there was Golden Ages in Civ 4, and I think Civ 3 as well.
No, I meant I meant Golden Age, Dark Age, Heroic
Age. Dark
Age
is new, and Heroic Age is new as well.
Was that in the expansion, though? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, that's expansion, yeah. Rise and Fall.
So I'm just saying, adding that and having, you know, and suddenly, you know, doing stuff, accomplishing stuff, you know, now I want to be the first to get my boat on the water, because now I'll get 3 points instead of 2 points towards my, you know. And getting your special units will get you, Golden Age and all that stuff. And it's fine, you know, even Dark Ages, you know, you might want a Dark Age because you have the special Dark Age policies that'll actually give you a boost. Like, I'm not going to be making any new settlers, so I might as well make that thing that bumps up, I think it's production. There's one Dark Age policy that bump up production, but you can't have any workers or settlers, you know.
I think it's settlers.
No, settlers.
You don't have workers. You have whatever they're called again.
Yeah. So it's like, but like I said, the core of Civilization VI is that all the developers grew up as Civilization fans, you know?
Yeah.
It's a fan game. And it's a good fan game, like that Sonic game that was not done by Team Sonic. What was that, Sonic Heroes, was it?
Yeah, Sonic Heroes was the team one.
Yeah, that was the fan game. So anyways... So yeah, I mean, it's hard to forget that. It's hard to remember that Rise and Fall actually came out the past year.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it had always been a part of Civilization VI. That's how good the expansion is. And I, like I said, I cannot wait until Gathering Storm, especially with all the new civs that are coming with it.
Yeah. Like, the ones that have been coming out are actually enough to make me care to maybe want to dip my toes back into Civilization VI again, because that's some cool diversity they're putting in.
Yeah. Anyway, speaking of which, now, for those of you who don't know, TJ is a ranked competitive fighting game, and Dragon Ball FighterZ is not on the list for a reason, and the reason is this game.
Blaze Blue Cross Tag Battle is basically all the things that people like about Dragon Ball FighterZ, but with a cast that 70% of them don't do Kamehameha waves. Like, that's neat and all, and there are little things in Dragon Ball FighterZ that make it technically cool.
TJ, but... I have to share a joke real quick. There's a picture where they show Gohan or whatever saying Kamehameha, and they show Kamehameha from Civ going, "Who keeps saying my name?"
Now let's take a step back here. Here's the thing. It's not like the developers are going to be upset with you for liking Blaze Blue over Dragon Ball FighterZ, is because Arc System Works did both of them. So, And they have to wonder if one of them was basically an assignment to them, while Blaze Blue was basically, you know, a project of love. I mean, they're both capable, you know, but it seems like, go ahead.
And Dragon Ball FighterZ, it's a really impressive visual game, as far as like they pay so much homage to the series in a way that any person who's ever watched that anime at any point in their life can enjoy.
Well, question then: how far back with Blaze Blue do you go? Do you go all the way back to Calamity Trigger?
I go all the way back to Calamity Trigger.
You don't know, it started out as an arcade game before it became an anime. If I remember correctly. Was Blaze Blue? Was Calamity
Trigger? Oh, no, I was talking about Dragon Ball FighterZ when I was saying about, like.
And a manga, just so you know.
But when I look at Dragon Ball FighterZ, there is love in there. There is serious commitment to the source material. And it's cool how much they care about, like, everything from Dragon Ball Super to the original Dragon Ball. But, like, as far as, like, Blaze Blue goes, not only did they figure out a way to take characters from most of the anime games they've worked on and put them in one place, but they added a Marvel vs. Capcom formula to it, and they balance these characters out so that they that there's all sorts of ways to make them work. And that's just so fun. Like, figuring out who my team was a serious commitment. And once I found them, I felt so I felt like I'd found something that nobody else had found, and I made it, and I took it to places like Canada Cup last year, and I came in 9th place out of 100 people, and that's nothing to sneeze at. It was so rewarding to get good at that game in a way that, like, I've played Tekken, I've played Soul Calibur, I've played Guilty Gear and Dragon Ball FighterZ, but there's a certain point where, like, if I'm not continually challenged to figure out new things and change myself, and if there's no reward for it, I get bored.
You know, Blaze Blue, for those who don't know, that was the first fighting game I can think of in which there were personalized quotes at each other. You know, mm-hmm. like Injustice does, you know, they actually did that before everybody else.
That's not true. King of Fighters has been, but King of Fighters has been around since 96, and they've always done something like that.
Yeah, I know, but here's the thing. The story mode in Blaze Blue has always been miles ahead of that.
I mean, I'm not going to argue with that, but the story in Blaze Blue is also batshit crazy.
So is the game. I mean, look at Tuokara. I keep forgetting it. Taokaka.
Just Taokaka, you know, the cat girl?
A cat with giant claws. It's like Wolverine, except as a cute cat.
I mean, my favorite character is Hazama, who is basically a combination of Michael Jackson and Gin Ichimaru from Bleach.
I mean, here's the thing. The Blaze Blue games, they don't care. They're just going to go wild, batshit crazy.
Yes. And so, like, when it comes down to
it, they fucking have a magician, if I remember correctly. Or a little bird magician? Or he has a little top hat?
You're probably talking about Carl Clover, and he has a giant puppet that follows him around that he calls his sister.
Look, you know what? You know what you can do? Pause this podcast, go to Blaze Blue Characters, and just get binge on what they've come up with.
And then go listen to the music, because some of those themes are some of the best out there as far as fighting games go. Like, so, I mean, the character that we were talking about, Carl Clover, his battle theme is the swankiest ass fucking jazziest shit I've ever heard in a fighting game, and I love it. Purple Marionette is really fun.
Let's stop talking about Blaze Blue and talk about what makes Blaze Blue Cross Tag Battle different from the rest of the series.
So it's got a much, much lower ceiling of entry, or like
it's easier. It's easier to get into. Got it.
Yeah, the other Blaze Blue games were very technical, and the Arc System Works games in general have always been very technical. Dragon Ball FighterZ started off a theme last year of being easier to access, and they took that over to Blaze Blue and made these characters, like, you don't have to study a character forever to figure out exactly what they can do. You don't have to master these most intricate button presses. Like,
yeah.
Hazama's instant kill move used to be like diagonal bottom sweep, other way diagonal, and then it was just all sorts of crazy.
I hate special moves that have diagonals in them. They're worse than, you know, the sweeping in which you go, in which you make a half circle or whatever with your, you know, doing diagonals sucks.
Mm-hmm. So they simplified everything and every input for each character down to the point where everybody has the same inputs. It's just quarter forward sweeps and a button.
Let me ask you a question. You ever play Skullgirls?
You don't have to focus on. Yes.
Yeah.
That too is a little bit technical.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying because I just realized that Skullgirls is basically a fan version of Blaze Blue.
Well, it's an indie version, and it's really impressive the way that they put that together. I could get into a whole thing on Skullgirls in by itself, but
I remember when Skullgirls was announced, it was crowdfunded, and people just were like already heavily invested into it. It was sort of like, yeah, this is our game.
Yeah,
I'm glad it was good. But and then the character design is batshit crazy, even more batshit crazy in it.
It's really fun, the way that they did that. They stuck so much to that that sort of rubber band animation.
Yeah.
But Blaze Blue Cross Tag Battle.
Now I'm thinking, if what was the name of that game again? It was just last year. Damn it! It was the best Xbox One game.
Oh, Cuphead.
Yeah, if Cuphead were a fighting game.
Exactly. But yeah, for BlazBlue Crosstag Battle, you don't have to think about the inputs. They're super easy. All you have to think about is what your character can do with those inputs and how they might mesh up with other characters.
Sort of like Injustice 2.
Yeah, exactly. Except for thinking, except you're thinking about two characters in the same match, which sounds difficult at first, but the inputs are so easy that once you start to put it all together, it just feels like you're learning little bits at a time, learning what fits, learning. You're putting together a puzzle, you're putting together a puzzle at high speed that will eventually, hopefully, overcome somebody else's puzzle that they've put together. And so for that, I gotta say, like, BlazBlue Crosstag Battle has been a gift that kept on giving to me, and that is being a longtime fan of Arc System Works games. This one feels above the rest in a way that, like, I feel like I'm gonna be playing this one for a long time.
What's your game of the year? Because, I mean, you're not gonna be playing God of War all the, you know, for a long time. And here's the thing, folks, you know, if you've listened to the podcast, TJ likes to compete, and, you know, he often comes in the top 10.
Yeah, I'm going to be competing in Texas Showdown in May, which is in Houston, which is going to be a major one. I'm hoping to learn a few new things before I get there and see what I can do.
Now, if you win a trip to Japan as to fight in a tournament, make sure you include me as your personal assistant.
God, wouldn't that be nice? I don't know Japanese.
Neither do I, but I can fake it. Now, let's talk about the JRPG that doesn't know it's a JRPG, that actually wants to be anything but a JRPG, and that's Ni No Kuni 2, Scott.
I don't know why you say that, because it's JRPG.
Yeah,
like,
but it
crazy.
Has so many more non-JRPG elements, like base building and all that stuff.
Base building is JRPG. That was from Suikoden. I was going to say, it's like Suikoden and ActRaiser came together.
I was thinking more
that
like
sounds
King
cool
Story.
As fuck.
No, everything it's more you like said Little that, King Story than that, though.
Everything you said in that sentence about ActRaiser and Suikoden coming together just made me smile my ass off.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah, that's what I've been wanting to tell you, because, like I said, you're a deposed king, so you're on the run.
No, Scott, no. Let's talk about the very beginning of the game, in which you play the president in our world.
President. Well, you're some sort of leader.
You're the you are the president, according to the backstory. You're the president, the American president, and I believe you have a nuclear war, and you end up in this world.
Yeah, a nuclear bomb goes off and apparently sends you into the alternate world, the other world. And but basically, I want to just start off saying, and I should have started this off. This game does like a whole. It took everything from Ni No Kuni 1. Threw it into a garbage can and just did a whole new thing.
That's
you know how
I was
you're
about to say
about
that. God I was about to say that, Scott, because
this one did a totally different.
I did not like Ni No Kuni, you know, the first one. What was it? The White Witch? Something of the White Witch?
Yeah, the White Witch, and it was Pokemon. It was so Pokemon.
It's just I didn't like the story either. The only thing I wish in Ni No Kuni 2 is that you kept playing as the president, as President Badass.
What do you do?
No, you become the assistant. You become the advisor for the actual king who's going to be there, because you have to help this prince and you know
character
and teach
is still
him how
there,
to be.
Though.
What? I know,
the
but I wish.
Is still there.
I know, but I wish he was the main character. He has a much more interesting story. I mean, in that, you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the game in which you played Chopin in his dreams, Eternal Sonata.
Oh yeah, Eternal Sonata.
I would have liked that more as a story in which it's basically Eternal Sonata except with an American president.
Yeah. And it was interesting. I haven't gotten far enough to find out why he's there or how he got sent there exactly and why he looked younger, apparently. I mean, I'm
well,
puzzling.
Japan looked
my
younger
head.
In his thing. Oh, actually, no, he always looked young in that, even though. Oh, never mind.
He was a little in Earth, and then when he was. Sent there, suddenly he looks younger. He even remarks like, "Wow, I look young for some reason."
Yeah,
he just goes with it. It's like, "Okay,
yes, I'm President Badass, and now I'm in a fantasy world. Let's go with it."
he is a badass character, I gotta say, because I think some people would be just falling apart, and he just goes like, "Well, this is where I am now."
Well, he was doing that even when the bombs were falling. It's like, yeah, fuck this. I'm the president. I'm going to deal with this shit. Yeah, the bombs are falling. Guess what? I have a feeling if he wasn't transported to the alternate world, he would have survived nuclear blast and said, yeah, I'm just radioactive and awesome now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be a new superhero. Super
so basically, him and the deposed king travel to a new place to, you know, start a new kingdom. So that way, Evan is the king, and he wants to unite the world under peace and no war. But you know, unfortunately, he's going to have to go to war to stop all wars. It's interesting because I want to see where this goes, and like I said, you build your castle and you have your town and you have all the little buildings that do specific things, and you recruit people like in Suikoden, and you have to do little quests, a little side quest to get the people, and you can assign them to these buildings to either, you know, be an armorer or go out hunting stuff and get you items and money, and just, it's really cool because you have kingdom building and in the end there's armies, so there's skirmishes, big battles that you control your little armies with. So I mean, this is just like,
you know, If Studio Ghibli wasn't doing the artwork, I would have guessed that it was another game that had been in production for a long time, and they said, "Oh, let's just call it Ni no Kuni 2."
I can see that too, because they also dropped the whole alternate people thing that they were doing in the first game, because it doesn't come up in this game at all, and I don't think it's going to at this point, because I'm 30 hours in. I think I would have seen it by now. So But they didn't totally, I guess, eject the story of the first game. What's cool is that there's this part where you have to go through a trial, and they make a nod to that first game by making story of the
first
game.
Well, they have to do that so people don't think, oh, this has nothing to do with Ni no Kuni.
Well, I mean, yeah, you almost wouldn't even realize that, because they boil it down to like these mythical figures that did these things, and you have to put the story together, and it was really a nice nod to it and a cool way to, you know, incorporate that and have and make you feel like you're still in that world. It's just very, very different from when you played in that first game.
So what do you think is the best part of the game to you?
I am really enjoying the base building. That's a lot of fun. I love building stuff. So, and I love that, and I love the art. I just love that there's a variety of things to do. You know, I can go fight some monsters, I can go do one of the skirmishes, I can do some base building, and, or, you know, just go explore the collectible stuff that you can do. So there's just a lot in this game.
Okay. So we're going to move on to me, and another game that I really liked is one that came out relatively late in the year, and that's Dusk. And it's basically the best game you'll ever play from the 1990s. Basically, Dusk is Quake, except jacked up with everything, but not in terms of density, just in terms of action and shooting and all that stuff. It's like they made Quake, except with today's computers instead, but had the same technology, you know, the same that rudimentary 3D from Quake. Did you play Dusk, TJ?
I didn't, but I know all about it. I've seen playthroughs of it and watched the way it goes. I'm not going to disagree with you. It is extremely 90s aesthetic, extremely 90s first-person shooter for anyone who just like loved digging around in Duke Nukem 3D, making maps and doing stuff like that. And just like it really is a love letter to that era.
And here's the thing. It's a good game. I mean, you can make all the homages you want. But the the puzzles are subtle, you know, and it's basically key card stuff, you know. But that, again, that was the 90s. But, you know, here's the thing. Usually when I'm playing something like Quake, I can find one or two secret areas. I could not find a single one in the first few levels, and there was supposed to be a bunch of them. And I'm thinking, where? I think what happens is that they know it's 2018 and people are going to communicate faster where all these secret areas are, so they really had to make them tough to find.
Mm. I feel like this is going to be something like there was a news story this last year that finally somebody had discovered the last known secret in Doom 2.
Yeah.
I feel like this is going to be one of those things where, like, if people – and people do enjoy this game. I see a lot of people talking about Dusk. I see a lot of people playing it regularly.
But here's the thing. You know, we're going to be talking about one of your games later, Mega Man 11, and we're going to talk about stuff. And, you know, the retro aesthetic has been there, you know, but mostly in platformers. This is the first time I can think of, really, in which a major indie game was acclaimed for mimicking a shooter, you know, from the era.
Yeah, because a lot of these things that try to do that, if they do try to go that route, like where they try to make a pixelated, blocky shooter, it just does not translate well to 2018.
I remember there was actually a Doom mod, which just made all the violence jacked up, you know, in which. I mean, there was so much jibbing, and there wasn't really all that much jibbing in Doom, but this one they just had you do different kinds of jibs, you know, like taking a chair and just smashing it on an enemy's head and making it explode, that sort of thing. Dusk, actually, you know, Dusk reminds me more of Blood than it does of Quake. At least the first levels do, because you're in the middle of a cornfield and, you know, you're running around. But yeah, I mean, Dusk is an unwindy game in which you just play just to chill out, you know. Yeah, it's fast-paced. Yeah, it's a shooter. But it's the sort of fast-paced shooter in which you're like, yeah, I'm zoning out. It's good. So let's talk about your next game, Tetris Effect. And here's the thing. I'm going to say a shameful secret. I don't care about Tetris Effect, and I played it. I'm sorry. It's true. Maybe my mind would be different if I played it in VR, but I don't think so. But it's made by the same guy who did Luminous.
It's still Tetris. If you can't like sit down and just like get into hours and hours of Tetris, then I can see where like you probably not going to get
I
into
like
this
Luminous,
as much.
Though Luminous is basically it's a variation on Tetris, and it uses music, you know. But Tetris Effect, you know, it isn't as good as Luminous, and maybe that's unfair. You know, Tetris Effect is good. It's not.
I also just don't think that's true. I just think it's Tetris. It's just all it is Tetris.
That's
with
fine,
a whole,
but,
with
you know,
a whole bunch of new like music and effects to go with it.
I'm just saying it's like people heap praise on it like it was so special. It's Tetris, the good music, you know. And I played Luminous. Maybe that's the problem. I played Luminous, so I've already had that. I've already had that combination.
And once you do slap on the headset and play it in VR, it really is just like an experience.
Yeah. I think they have a Zen mode too.
It really, yes. And it just, it's so relaxing to just sit down to that game, be able to look around the Tetris board, mess around with all the colors and music coming at you. If it's not without the VR, I mean, it's just basic Tetris, but with the VR, it really pops and is one of the most relaxing gaming experiences I had in 2018.
Now you have me thinking about Luminous VR. Someone get on that.
I mean, you really should give it a try in VR if you ever get the chance sometime. I'm not going to say it's going to change your mind.
I did, but like I said, it's Tetris. And it has music. And like I said, if I hadn't played Luminous, then I'd probably have been more wowed.
So I'm just a Tetris fan. I really am.
I'm just saying, I played Luminous, though. So it's like I already had the Tetris effect 10 years before the Tetris effect. Anyways, Scott, you love your isometric JRPGs. Did you finally finish Pillars 2?
Oh, yeah, I finished Pillars 2 a while ago.
Oh, wait, no, it's the expansion I'm thinking of then.
The expansions is the thing. I waited for all the expansions to come out, and then I'm going to do a new game and play all the expansion stuff. And they've changed some things. They've tweaked some stuff. They've added a whole lot of new challenges, which they're called the Gods Challenges, where you can do stuff like you have, like, limited items, or you have... like, there's a fog of war now, and...
Let's talk about Pillars 2, though. The biggest thing to me about Pillars 2 was there was a lot more character interaction between the party members this time. I mean, it was, you know, Baldur's Gate, I remember the first time in which, remember, you had your party, but they were going to split up because you had evil people and good people, and it's just like, you know, they eventually, you know, started infighting. Pillars 2 isn't quite like – I mean, you can have that, but it's more like – there's a lot of more interpersonal contact in that game.
There are people that will straight up hate other characters in this game. I don't know if it'll go as bad as a split leaving, but there was one point where I had a character saying, it's either me or her, you know, she keeps offending me, and I think I managed to keep them from killing each other.
Wow, you were Roy Greenhalgh from The Order of the Stick.
I guess.
TJ, do you read The Order of the Stick?
No, I didn't.
I did.
Okay, you have to read The Order of the Stick. It's a basically good party, but they have one evil psychopathic halfling named Belkar Bitterleaf.
You do build character reputations, and basically having traits like honest or sneaky or jovial, and they'll like you more if you pick a response that goes along with that trait.
Here's the thing. I didn't really like Pillars of Eternity that much. I felt it was like trying to be Baldur's Gate. But Pillars 2 at least built upon Pillars of Eternity and made it that much more important, not more important, but that better a game. Especially when you have the competition like Divinity, right? Which runs on that trope. So I think Pillars 2 had to say, well, you know what, if Larian's going to do that, we better up our game.
They definitely did, and they went to a new region and they continued the story of the gods, story of what's going on. And what was pretty interesting is that the last part of the game, you're not even fighting a final boss. You're having a conversation with the god.
Yeah,
and
it's basically
fighting
to save
the world. So, I mean, I thought that was kind of refreshing and different.
Well, I mean, it's been done. I mean, Planescape Torment and Fallout and, you know, but it's nice to have a game in which you don't have to do combat to finish the game.
That was another thing about this game, is that you had more opportunity to talk your way out of something or find another way. It didn't feel so bloodthirsty, you know. It gave you more options to figure something out and try to not always do the violent solution. That is nice to have in a game like this. And of course they did the I guess what looks like the old style RPG stuff where they have a text thing and you pick a choice of what you want to do. So they had that in there as well.
Oh, you know what? Here's the thing. It was good for Mass Effect to have the, you know, two or three words response and then he does it. But for something like Dragon Age Origins, I preferred the long, seeing what you were exactly going to say, you know, not... Mm-hmm. You know, I like having the dialogue options that are full dialogue options, which have all of the...
Yeah, people complained about that in Fallout 4, is that they would have a text option, they would click it...
Yeah,
and
sarcastic,
it totally
or...
different.
Yeah.
I remember in Mass Effect 2, there was definitely a couple of renegade options where you, like, pick it, and you're like, oh, that doesn't sound so bad. And things happen like Shepard kicking a guy over and shooting him in the face or something, and it's just like, oh, my God!
It's not what I wanted.
Well, if you're a renegade, guess what? That's what happens.
Yeah, and like stuff like that...
But it isn't that
one-dimensional.
Yeah, I just mean, you know, like in when you play Dragon Age Origins and you see the dialogue, you can see the wit of the main character there, and you can you know, and when they react, you know what they're reacting to. I mean, when you play Dragon Age 2, it's sort of like, do you want to do the diplomatic response or do you want to do, you know, I want him to say something that has nothing to do with diplomacy or nothing to do with happiness or nothing to do with snarkiness or evil or whatever. I just want him to say that sentence.
And in Pillars, the whole Pillars Eternity series, they did away with alignments. So everything is really shades of gray. And you have to evaluate people by their actions. And there's not a, you know, pick evil face or pick happy good face. It's, you know, pick these options and you got to figure out yourself if this character really aligns with what you want, because a lot of these characters feel that they are doing the good thing or the right thing, and that, you know, this is against their views, but they still feel that they're doing the right thing. Have characters, you know, that
we all know whose influence this is Chris Avalon's influence, and I know that really makes me and TJ look forward to Dying Light 2, since Chris Avalon's gonna be doing that, and they already showed that your actions have consequences in that game too.
Yes, and I know Obsidian what did they just what was this game called that they just announced? I forgot what it's called.
You mean Borderlands crossed with
that would be The Outer Worlds.
Yeah, The Outer Worlds. I'm trying to remember.
Yeah.
It's Borderlands crossed with Fallout.
Yeah, so I'm interested in that as well. So that'll probably have good character stories there as well. I mean, they keep the ball rolling.
Yeah.
You know,
that major news of the year was, you know, Microsoft bought Obsidian and In Exile. And the Outer Worlds is not a Microsoft game because they already had an agreement with someone else. But it's also going to be an advertisement for everything that they're going to be doing with Microsoft. And you know, and by the way, it's going to be an Xbox Game Pass game. So,
yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I don't get excited about something until I see what the gameplay looks like. But I have yet to be disappointed by Obsidian. I mean, we all know what they're capable of.
Here's the thing: their worst is still okay.
Yeah, I mean, if you go into Obsidian game, and at the very least, you have
bugs. Yeah. You'd have a lot of bugs, and you have to wait 3 months for it to be fixed.
Lots of games have bugs.
But Obsidian is notorious for their bugs.
Sure, but I've never gone into an Obsidian game and like spent 30 hours to be like, this is shit. I can't stand it anymore.
You know, one game that people dump on is Alpha Protocol, but it's one of my favorite games by Obsidian.
It was definitely one of the most ambitious ones they ever did, and it's one of those games that deserves an HD remake with some of the wrinkles flattened out.
I just want an Alpha Protocol 2, damn it. Although the ending of Alpha Protocol, no matter what you picked, it's gonna be, you know, it's sort of like Deus Ex. You know, we're gonna have to do a completely different story with a different character, which I wouldn't mind really.
I just hope that there'll still be a Pillars 3 one day. But,
there is. Don't worry about that. Okay. I mean, you know. Actually, you know, Microsoft, it's interesting what they said about In Exile and Obsidian. They said that they want Obsidian and Exile to do what they do best, you know, and that is to make AA games. And, you know, it's hard, you know, that's what Pillars of Eternity 2 really is. It's a AA game. You know, it's not a AAA game, but it's also not an indie game. It's one of those games which is, and we need those mid-level games, you know. We don't need everything to be, you know, Battlefield 5. We don't need everything to be, you know, Stardew Valley. You know, it's nice to have a game that is pretty, it is ambitious, but it also didn't cost $500 billion to make.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I agree with that.
So who knows? Maybe Microsoft will tell them, hey, you want to make Pillars 3? Fine. Because here's the thing, you know, Microsoft buying Obsidian and In Exile was not for the Xbox. It was for the PC. They wanted to make PC games. That, by the way, can also work on the Xbox, too. Anyways, we're going to mine, and mine is basically the spiritual successor to Theme Hospital. That's Two Point Hospital. Did either of you play it?
No. I looked at it, though.
Yeah, I never made it around to that one.
So, if you ever played Theme Hospital, but even more so, it's the best Dungeon Keeper game you'll play. And the developers you worked on Theme Hospital. Now, Theme Hospital, I think it came after Dungeon Keeper, but basically it's Dungeon Keeper except in a hospital. And that's basically it. And it's done perfectly. I mean, when I was playing it, I felt like I was playing Theme Hospital just with slight... Here, the graphics aren't even that much better than Theme Hospital, by the way. Maybe a little bit sharper, but it's the same exact graphics. And I was expecting people to come in with bloaty head, but they didn't come in, unfortunately. Instead, you had people with light bulb heads in which you had to twist off their head and replace it. There's so many grody diseases in it. I mean, in Theme Hospital, you had the squits. And, you know, so if you like a Dungeon Keeper type game, you know, simulation, you know, a base building game, the Two Point Hospital is really good. And it also scales with your ability level. You could stay in the opening spot for as long as you want. The game doesn't care. You know, just keep making money there. But if you want to keep on progressing, you know, to the different parts of the land, you know, there's an island and all that stuff, go right ahead. But there's nothing forcing you forward. It's sort of like, you want to enjoy this? Enjoy this. If you don't, if you get bored of this, we can move on if you want to. Or you can just build your hospital from the first land and just keep it there. this is what a lot of people wish the first Roller Coaster Tycoon would do.
Man, I really, really, really wish they'd make another Evil Genius game.
They were. It was going to be Evil Genius Online. That's a stuck in development hell. I don't know what's happened to it.
Yeah, I have no idea either. But things like this, they are fun. They are definitely like time killers, and you can do so much with them. But
here's the thing about it. It's legitimately funny.
Yeah.
That's what we don't have in a lot of games. Actual games that are trying to be funny. By the way, one of the games we did not list, and I forgot to mention, is that last year, shock of all shocks, we actually had a good Leisure Suit Larry game. And it was actually funny, and it didn't rely on self-reference, although it did do a lot of self-referencing. But the game on its own is pretty funny. And,
yeah.
You know.
It did a lot of, like, it did new jokes, and like, even though it was set in that
Fish Out of Water game, yeah.
Yeah. So it was weirdly good how the animation was, because they spent a little too much time doing those stupid 3D ones that sucked ass.
Box office bust. I was actually enjoying Box Office Bust, but then the action sequences just were too buggy for me to deal with, because it was over the top bad in its humor. Not even ha-ha bad, but cringeworthy. But I was enjoying the cringeworthy humor. And I was enjoying it on that basis alone, like you'd watch a bad movie like The Room or Showgirls. But you got to get rid of the bugs so that I can actually complete some of these action sequences.
Yeah. But here we are with another point and click with Leisure Suit Larry, and it actually feels like...
Oh, and it's an actual adventure game, too, in which you have to think, unlike a Telltale game in which you just move ahead in the story.
Click everything, try to put everything together. So
I think it's telling that Al Lowe was not involved with this game. I think his time was done.
Which is fine.
Fresh and new.
He hasn't made a Leisure Larry game in
point
a long
click,
time.
Point and click he did. I mean, not Box Office Busted, all that stuff. But he did all the point and click games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everything up to the sixth game.
Yeah. You know, those horrible abominations in between this game and those were other people as well. So, but yeah.
Yeah. So, speaking of retro, TJ, your game was Mega Man 11. Although, unlike Mega Man 9 and Mega Man 10, it was not trying to emulate an NES game. It was actually just being, hey, look, we can do Mighty No. 9 better than you.
Well, yeah. I mean, they took the original Mega Man formula. They still stuck with the whole, like, Mega Buster and getting all the weapons and everything. But they really did sort of reinvent the wheel in a unique way with this one, with the gear system.
But if you looked at it, it looked like Mighty No. 9. Admit it. It looked almost exactly like Mighty No. 9. They were putting their thumb and saying, look, we can make a better Mighty No. 9 than you can.
Well, the only other reason it looked like a Mighty No. 9 is because they finally took Mega Man and did like a pseudo 3D thing with it, 3D on the 2D plane. Which, when you put it that way, yes, it's definitely going to look like Mighty No. 9 because that's what Mighty No. 9 was trying to do well.
Did you play 20XX? Or has that come out?
Yes, I've played it.
Oh, okay, how does it compare to Mega Man 11, not to Mighty No. 9?
it's a roguelike 2D. Which, it's neat, but I wouldn't say that it's exactly like a Mega Man game. It's more like a go until you die game. It's like if Mega Man was an endless runner, which is weird.
Actually, that's
but
not
also,
a bad idea.
Yeah, it's weird, but also cool in its own way. Mega Man 11 is a completely, like, it's a Mega Man game. And it's a Mega Man game that, like, it really did feel... like it should for those old things that are really cool. But like then there's this gear system. One of them is the speed gear, which slows down time. And the other one is the power gear, which powers up your weapons and makes all the boss weapons do different things. And so you unlock this new level of play with the game where, like, when are you going to use the speed gear? When are you going to use the power gear? You can't use them infinitely, because if you do, they burn out. So it really is this sort of thing where, like, you use up the gauge to a certain point, and then you let it power down, and you really have to decide which sections you're going to dedicate to which gear in a level. And that's kind of made it really fantastic for speedrunners, because, like, everybody's trying to figure out, well, how do I use the weapons and the gear system to produce the most interesting results?
There's never been a bad Mega Man game, has there? There's never been a mediocre one either. I mean, they've all had that high level
That's not true. There are bad Mega Man games.
Numbered ones.
Mega Man X 7 and 8, or 6, 7, and 8 are pretty awful.
Are you sure?
Yeah. Mega Man X 6 was never supposed to be made. It was supposed to end at Mega Man X 5, and then they just pushed through and made Mega Man X 6 anyways. And it shows.
No, maybe I was blinded by 9 and 10.
And then Mega Man X 7 and 8 are the ones where they tried to do this pseudo 3D thing, and they're just bad.
Here's the thing. I think because Mega Man 9 and Mega Man 10 were so good, it's sort of like I made the assumption,
I just seem to remember the Mega Man games. I felt like they were scraping the barrel at some points with their man ones. I just can't remember which one it was exactly.
Superman. He has the power of soup.
Oh, I mean, like, there's straight up a robot in Mega Man, I think, 9 that's basically Sheep Man, and he's a sheep man.
So, here's the thing about the next game we're going to talk about, and that's Octopath Traveler. Now, imagine you took a typical 16-bit JRPG, you know, an exploratory sort of 2D. Now, imagine using modern-day filters and lighting and shadows and diffusion and add 3D to it, and basically you have Octopath Traveler. It's like someone took a 16-bit game and said, okay, we're going to inject you with steroids now.
Mm-hmm. And this was Scott's pick.
This is Scott's pick, yeah. Scott, you're supposed to talk about this game.
Oh, okay, sorry, yes. Octopath Traveler is the game where you have 8 different characters and you can follow their stories, each individually, or recruit them all and do their chapters one at a time.
That's why it's called Octopath.
Yes, Octopath. And you have to use your abilities during combats to break the shield on enemies. That way they get, like, stunned, and then your attacks are double damage. So there's definitely strategy there with your skills in each character.
Let's talk about the look of the game. I mean, this game...
Oh, yeah.
This game is a 16-bit game, but it has 3D and shadows and diffusion and fog, actual volumetric fog. And, you know, it looks like someone took a... it looks like someone took a 16-bit game and put it in real life. This is what it looked like if you take the world from a 16-bit game and just put it in reality, but maintained the graphics of it.
Yeah, like 2D drawn sprites in a 3D environment.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, actually, in our environment, not a game environment. It's sort of like, because it goes whole hog on the visual effects. You know, like water. You know, you have,
and they have
really
these
good water
sparkling
effects.
Little effects too.
Yeah,
it's very well done. Very, very good detail. Very good music. You do feel like you're playing a new 16-bit game, but that's been given that field of view.
But the cartridge
would
have to be the size of a Pringles can.
Yeah,
it'd be a 16-bit game, except the cartridge have to be the size of a Pringles can.
Oh yeah, that too. I think I did mine digitally, so I didn't have to worry about the cartridge. And I enjoyed the story so far. And once you get all the 8 characters, they do have reactions. They'll have little scenes where they'll give a reaction to another character's chapter or what's going on with them. So there is some character interaction.
Scott,
but
you haven't finished
it? Not a whole lot.
You didn't finish it, Scott?
I have not finished it, no.
Oh, okay.
It is... really interesting to see how many lessons from other JRPGs came together in this one. Mm-hmm. I mean, the love for like the Saga Frontier type of RPG is evident from the characters and how they intertwine and how you can just jump back and forth between them. I have missed a Saga game so badly.
Yeah, and the bosses are definitely challenging. They will level up as your characters level up. So no matter what chapter you're in or in what order you do things, the character, the bosses will go up in level. So that is definitely like from Saga. And I feel like it's much more forgiving too, because there was this life bar mechanic in Saga that always made things difficult for me, because you'd have your life and then you'd have your second life or whatever it was called. I can't remember what it was called, but it was like, yeah, it was a very small amount of points. So if you died, you were like permadeath or something, and or you got stats were reduced. And it just made I had a hard time, like I said, with the Saga Frontier games. But this game is much easier, but also still very challenging.
Mm-hmm. And then there's like there's certain things.
You know, the guy who did Bravely was brought in to work on the game, so there's mm-hmm. that influence.
Oh, Brave Default, yeah.
And I mean, I see other things in there too. I see reference to like Xenogears. Mm-hmm. Firstly, with like the 2D sprites, well done, and put in this good 3D environment. Which, I mean, the 3D environments in Xenogears aged like milk, but but so did everything from the original PS1 days.
I think I could still play Xenogears. That's definitely a game I can go back to.
Uh huh. And the reason for that is like the martial arts system in Xenogears is so fucking fun.
Here's the thing, you know. The developers said that this game was specifically a spiritual successor to Final Fantasy VI.
It feels like Final Fantasy VI graphics.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of game mechanics, actually.
It's all over the place.
Yeah.
And in a good way. Like, there's a lot of retro-styled games where they take too many things and put it together, and they take bad things from retro games and put them in there because they're like, haha, remember this shit? And it sucks. Like, anyone who wants to emulate the water levels from Ninja Turtles is an asshole, and they should stop making games.
You know, here's the interesting thing. You know, this game, according to the developer, was made – the target audience were guys in their 30s and 40s. So this game was deliberately running on nostalgia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like it's something that I appreciate about people making these retro style games. It's like, if you're gonna take the things from old games, take the good things and leave the bad things out. And that's kind of what Project Octopath Traveler did. It's not perfect, but it is really, really good as far as just like taking the things we loved from those old RPGs and putting them together in one good package.
It definitely does the one-third rule, one-third old, one-third new, one-third, like, just totally, you know, changed mechanics. I like also that you have this more incentive to interact with various NPCs when you can either recruit them or steal from them or buy stuff from them or challenge them to a duel.
So that's kind of like Persona.
Mm-hmm. So it makes it more in-depth, and again, gives you more to do in each town. It feels like a long and kind of big game, because you're going through each person's journey. But it's definitely a fun game.
So, my next game is Batman: The Enemy Within. And strictly because of the story, I mean, the artwork is good, the dialogue is good, but, you know, this game, here's the thing I like about this, the Telltale Batman series. It looks at the Batman canon and says, fuck that, we're going to tell our own story. Joe Chill was not just some random mugger. He was an assassin. The Waynes, they were mobsters. And, you know, and Alfred was actually trying to keep Bruce away from, you know, and all this stuff. You know, Vicky Vale is a villain. It's just... And the way they did the origin of the Joker is just so well done.
You know, it's not an uncommon thing in comics to do these what-if scenarios. Like, Marvel is known for, like, what would have happened if Captain America hadn't been shot and stuff like that.
Well, DC has their Elseworlds, too.
And this Batman: The Enemy Within is like a really well told
Batman game too.
Batman: The Enemy Within is like a really well told what if.
Yeah, like what if Harley Quinn was the one in charge at first? And here's the thing, they hint around at it, but that stuff that Amanda Waller wants was actually what drove them crazy, and they're under the effects of that secret thing, which is why they all want it. But I really like the characterization of Amanda Waller. Here's the thing, Suicide Squad turned Amanda Waller into a sociopath who didn't give a shit about our team. Even her first appearance in Suicide Squad, she butted heads with them, but she never thought the Suicide Squad was expendable, ever. You know, even though they're called the Suicide, she cared for everybody, including Captain Boomerang. At least in this one, you know, she cares about her team first and foremost, fuck everything else. And I like that, you know. Agent Avesta is in trouble, you know, and it's like, to get on her good side, you can, you know, beat up on the bad guys and also save her people first, you know. And, you know, I mean, it's an alternate history of Batman, and I just ate it up. And one of the things that we have to talk about is that the fifth episode actually does have two separate storylines. Spoiler, either the Joker becomes a vigilante or a villain. And they're both completely different. So you actually do get what people have been complaining about with Telltale, is that the story they tell, you know, they'll remember this and that, but it's always going to end the same way. Not so with the Enemy Within. The Enemy Within actually has two different endings that are completely different, which is great. And, oh, by the way, I prefer Villain Joker because he gets Harley to say, "I always knew you had it in you, Mr. J."
Huh.
So, TJ, you obviously played Batman: The Enemy Within, right? TJ?
No, but I followed the story from the beginning. Okay. And just like I was always enthralled with like the branching. I've always been enthralled with some of the branching choices in the Telltale games that aren't Walking Dead. And Batman with the Enemy Within, it was like an interesting take on all of that. It's nice to see somebody that takes the established lore and just flips it on its head. And not like just in a weird, like, thoughtless way, but actually fleshes out the opportunity to play with that lore.
Well, it's like, what if Batman's parents were mobsters? You know, what if they were illegal and, from all accounts, Thomas Wayne was just as bad as, or even worse, actually, than Carmine Falcone? Mm-hmm. You know, and Martha was at least a little bit, you know, but, you know, they drove Vicki Vale's parents insane. You know, did terrible things, you know, and now you have Bruce trying to reconcile with the fact that, you know, his parents were shit. Why are you still Batman?
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, I mean, if you only, you know, here's the thing. I can't say play season two without playing season one because it sets it up so perfectly. But season two is a great climax. And it's sad that we probably will never see a season three because of everything that's going on with Telltale. Because I want to be more in that universe, that specific universe. And I don't want it to be a comic book, and I don't want it to be a novel. I want it to be a video game so I can continue making choices.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that Telltale had to go down. Like, not for Walking
Horribly
Dead.
Horribly mismanaged.
Like, we'll never see the Wolf Among Us 2, which was one of my most anticipated upcoming things. We'll never see another... We'll never see another season of Batman: The Enemy Within. There's so many good things that Telltale was doing.
Now, here's the thing. I think Batman: The Enemy Within undersold. Otherwise, you know, you have Warner Brothers in DC. They could just say, fuck it, we'll pay you to do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But if it didn't make enough money, then maybe not.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I'm still hoping that we'll see The Wolf Among Us 2 because that ended on a great ending, and I really do want to see more of Bigby.
Mm-hmm.
And Snow White's turning into a cunt, and I want to see what happens with her.
Yeah, there's a lot to the Fable comic book series that they can pull from and put in.
The real question is, whether it would take place still before the comic book series? Because here's the thing. We're talking about John Marston, you know, how we knew he was going to survive in Red Dead Redemption 2. Well, we all knew Snow White was going to survive in The Wolf Among Us because she's in the comic, and this takes place before the comic. So I'm wondering if they're going to take place during it or after it or still before it.
Yeah. I mean, it would be fun to see something that comes after, but you have to explain the middle part somehow, and I don't know what you do with that.
Could someone still buy the IPs for these various games?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, the licenses are out there.
Well, here's the thing. The thing is that Telltale's buying the licenses, not the games, so it's not like, you know... I mean, you can have a Spider-Man, but it's not going to be Telltale's Spider-Man. You know?
Sure.
Anyways, moving to the next item. Okay, I have to ask you a question. Why this game? Why?
Fist of the North Star Lost Paradise? Because the anime is one of the most over-the-top, ridiculous things anyone could ever say comes out of anime.
What about One Punch Man?
I mean, yeah. Where do you think One Punch Man got all its ideas?
Yeah, you got me there, yes.
Fist of the North Star, it represents the most anime of all anime. And I say that knowing that like things like Sailor Moon, Dragon Ball Z, and Naruto exist. Fist of the North Star is the original, just most ridiculous thing out there.
Say what you want about him, at least he doesn't go into a Super Saiyan mode. Of course, he is the Super Saiyan mode.
He's just Super Saiyan all the time.
Yeah.
There's quite a variety of different anime. It's not all yelling and screaming, big swords and stuff.
I know, but like Fist of the North Star represents all of that very well.
But here's the thing about Fist of the North Star. Before we actually discuss the game, at least it's grounded in some reality. I mean, when you watch Dragon Ball Z, it's sort of like that is all screaming and all, and oh, I'm gonna invent this new power as we go along. It just, you know, at least Fist of the North Star, it says, well, you have this guy who he punches you and then you'll die like a minute later. You're dead but don't even know it. But at least it's grounded in some way with how people react to him. You know?
Yeah.
But let's talk about the game. And the reason I wasn't questioning your pick of anime character. It's just wondering about this game.
So the game itself is like a perfect homage to the anime. It really is. Like to the point of telling all the memorable arcs. Which a lot of them leave out stuff that just doesn't translate well. Fist of the North Star Lost Paradise actually goes through those things. Like you go through the full arc to get to Shin and punch him in the heart for taking Ken's wife. And it's also done by the same people who did the Yakuza games. Yeah. And
Yakuza games, they're really a model of restraint, too.
Yeah, and I mean, there is a little bit of that whole schlock in there, where, like, one of the things is that you have to run a night, that you have an opportunity to...
So you're embracing it like the bad martial arts movie that it really is from the 70s.
Uh-huh. I love it for the schlock. I love it for the fact that it's, like, it's so ridiculous, but... If you can get into it and sit down and start to appreciate, just like, don't take it seriously, just have fun with the ride, then it's a great game.
Okay.
And I mean, there's nothing, and there's just, it's really button mashy when you do any of Ken's moves, but it really does feel satisfying when just like you punch a dude 100 times and then he just explodes.
So Scott,
so this is one of my this is a guilty pleasure game of the year, I would
obviously.
Say.
Obviously. I mean, I want people to go and Google Fist of the North Star Lost Paradise just to see what the game looks like.
Mm-hmm.
The game looks like schlock. It's not enough that the game is schlock. It looks like schlock. I mean, you can have all the Killer Sevens you want. At least they have they don't look like schlock. This looks like schlock. This looks like someone took a manga from the 90s and mixed it with schlock from the 70s and just put it in a blender.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you like God Hand, you'll love Fist of the North Star Lost Paradise.
let's move on, okay? So, Scott, your next game is actually a mashup of two games. as Bridge Constructor Portal, which takes Bridge Constructor and merges it with Portal.
Yeah, I was just surprised that I saw this game came out at the end of last year, 2017, sorry. And so I kind of got to play this for this year and got through like the first 20 levels. And it's a lot of fun to hear Gladys smack-talking me again. And
what if World of Goo was narrated by Gladys?
Right. And you get to make these bridges and you use physics in there. And it's really tricky doing that. I feel like I'm really having to go back to trigonometry and geometry and trying to figure out mathematically how do I get these bridges aligned and
Now you have to do the portal so you can shoot them, and I need to have this angle to shoot them,
right,
a specific angle, you know, and all that stuff.
And you could just watch your bridges fall apart fantastically and watch the drivers bounce around or get shot or thrown into vats of acid. So it's a very entertaining game and challenging, extremely.
Can you use the level editor?
Yeah, yes. Okay. There's a level editor, and
By the way, for those who don't know, this game actually looks like those posters that are on the walls. You know, those little flat sheet characters, you know.
Yeah.
That's what really gives it its charm.
After every 20 levels, I think, either 10 or 20 levels, your little shadow figure gets like a new thing. Like they'll plug in the computer, and then they'll give you like a camera that's watching you and tell you, oh, you can have sunlight and food now, and it's just funny.
Yeah. So, my next game, is Cultist Simulator. And, you know, Call of Cthulhu tried so hard to be H.P. Lovecraft. It tried so, so hard. But this was my number one PC game of the year because it was able to do it effortlessly. And basically, for those who haven't seen it, it's a card game. That's all it is. Cards on a table with sound effects and music and nothing else. And one of the things about Cultist Simulator, and it does something very brave in this day and age, it does not come with instructions. It does not come with any manuals. It comes with nothing. I mean, you could go to a wiki and figure it out, but the entire point of the game is for you to figure out its rules. And it does tell you what things do if you do the tooltips, but how things, you know, a strategy, you have to figure it out for yourself. You know? Have you played it, TJ?
No, but you talked about this game a lot during 2018, and it always sounded both the ultimate amount of frustrating and also just like entrapping. Just like,
yeah, it's one of those games in which, God, I suck at this, but I can't stop playing it. And it actually has DLC, which I got for free because I pre-ordered it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like if you look at the developer interviews, they went back and forth on whether to include a tutorial, and they eventually figured out no. Because I think I agree with them. If you give it a tutorial, it sort of takes away from the mystery of the game, because then it just becomes cards and numbers and all that stuff. You know, I still haven't gotten my own religion. The one thing I was able to do is live a happy life, which is basically its way of saying you lose. You did nothing with your life. You did nothing. You went to work and you forgot all about this cultist stuff. What kind of cult leader are you anyway?
Yeah. I mean, like, it does look like it has that sort of appeal where Civilization did, where like if you don't look up what you're doing with Civilization, you're probably not going to win. You're just going to learn how to do better each time.
Mm-hmm. Trial and error.
I mean, it is worth, you know, I think it's still $15. It's worth the $15 if you just want a game that's a card game and not a collectible card game either. I mean, those are just tons and tons of those. We don't need another Gwent. By the way, that's one popular game we have not talked about all year, and that's Gwent.
Yeah, I just don't hear much about it.
Yeah.
For what it was supposed to be, I never hear about Gwent. Like, no one ever tells me if it's good or if it's bad.
It exists.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Well, here's the thing I can tell you. It's exactly like it is in The Witcher. That's all.
Oh. That's it. Well, that doesn't sound bad, but that doesn't sound good
either. I mean, Fable
did
the same thing. Remember Fable table games? Fable that was actually just introducing you to the gambling that's in Fable beforehand, before Fable 2. So you could actually earn your money before you actually played Fable 2.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, Cultist Simulator is just dripping with atmosphere. The entire game runs on atmosphere. And at some point, I'm going to break down and I'm going to look at exactly how to play the game, you know, the most efficiently. But I don't feel like doing that just yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there is something to be said about victories without anybody's help on a game that you never... There was once a game, an old Electronic Arts game, in which it bragged it didn't come with any instructions. But the game was simple to figure out, though. It wasn't, you know, but this... You can tell what cards, how they interact, but what to do to maximize what the cards do, that is the game. And if you ever watch a Let's Play without any commentary, you'll see what I mean about atmosphere, you know. And you played Call of Cthulhu, right, TJ?
Yes. Well, I played the board game and then a little bit of the video game.
No, the video game, not the board game. The board game is oozing with atmosphere. I'm talking about the video game. Didn't it feel like the video game was trying way too hard? I mean, it took every single H.P. Lovecraft story and just swished it into one. Mostly, mm-hmm. of course, the Innsmouth story. But still, it was trying way too hard.
Go
ahead.
It was almost, in that particular instance, it really did feel like they were trying to put all of Call of Cthulhu into one quick experience. And quite frankly, that's something that probably would have been better served to be maybe in an episodic format. I don't know.
But Cultist Simulator, it's like the minute you start playing and you hear the music and you see the cards popping up. And oh, by the way, this game is a real-time game. You can pause it, right? But still, it's a real-time game. So time passes and, you know, you don't know the helplessness you have when you say, oh, shit, I'm going to die of starvation and there's nothing I can do about it. I'm not going to be able to earn the money fast enough to prevent myself from keeling over dying. But one of the good things, though, is that if you die or if you fail, you can resurrect into yourself or to someone else. And everything that was done before sort of lingers on. Sort of like, well, you died, but your spirit, you know. And they actually, if it's your first playthrough and you play again, it actually starts referring to your previous character. So there's sort of that, you know, out-of-time experience. But I guarantee, if you actually start playing Cultist Simulator, at the very least, you're going to feel like, yeah, there's something weird. There's some weird shit going on here. Anyways, speaking of atmosphere, let's talk about Gris. Or Grease? Gris.
Yeah.
We're talking about beautiful games. This one is the one that actually looks like a watercolor painting.
Yeah. We talked about some games are just great for what they are, but this one was actually just like a stylistic thing. And a lot of people compared it to Journey. I can see the comparison.
There was a game about depression that started the entire Gamergate thing. There was a game about depression, and that's what this game reminded me of, because it was a meditation on emotion and depression.
Isn't that just straight up called Depression Quest?
Depression Quest, that's right, yeah. Gris reminds me of Depression Quest.
Yeah, it really just, like, it doesn't handhold you through what's going on. You literally just have to take the visual and audio cues, and it's very minimalist.
I'm going to say something. Isn't it the most shocking thing that this is actually published by Devolver Digital? This is not the kind of game you think of when you think of Devolver Digital.
The same folks that put out Hotline Miami are behind this.
And also Serious Sam. I mean...
So this is just like... It really is an interesting sort of melancholy quest. Without too much in the way of sound, without too much in the way of spectacle, but it really is something very minimalistically very pretty. And I found myself just wanting to see more. Like, I just kept going. It's not a long game. It's not an incredibly long one. You can get it done in, I think, about 4 or 5 hours, I think. But it really does offer some unique interfacing and unique challenges. Like, there are puzzles to this game, and they're fun to figure out. There was one where I just, like, could not figure it out, and I thought the game was broken. Nope. And I was the idiot.
Here's the thing. I just sent you an article about how the game was built, okay? In terms of the way it was the artistic decisions and all that stuff, you know, everything that happens in the game is done for a reason, you know, and you have the ups and downs and they're plotted out, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not Gone Home. It's not a walking simulator. It's not like you don't play the game,
mm-hmm.
but it is a game that enforces certain ways to play it.
Yes. And, like, you discover little bits at a time what you can and cannot do, and it guides you through that a little bit in the way of, like, you – it doesn't give you, like – it tells you, like, one time how to do it, and then you can just figure out what you can do with that new ability, like swimming or diving or butt bombing or turning into a cube.
But I'm just glad that we have the technology that we can actually make a game that looks like a watercolor game through the entire thing, and there's never a period in which technically it has to leave that style. No, it's able to stay in that style the entire time. And mm-hmm. I think that's what we need from – when you say, oh, we need better video game advancements, I'm not thinking about, oh, we need photorealism. No, I'm thinking about stuff that in which you could have a painting that never stops being a painting and still remains a game and still has an action game. Sort of like, you remember in the beginning of BioShock when you're in the when you just crashed, right? And the opening is my cousin thought when I was playing the game, when you're swimming in the water, thought I was still in the cutscene.
Mm-hmm.
He did not know I was. That's what I'm talking about, you know. This game is a cutscene that you play.
Yes.
That is beautiful.
When people say when people mention games as art, that old chestnut of a debate, Gris is games as art. It's still a game. It's still something that you can play, and it does have reward and risk to it, but it also is just beautiful.
You know what? You know what other game Gris reminds me of? It was a LucasArts game from a while ago. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's called Lucidity. It was basically a game in which you play a little girl who's sort of like Little Red Riding Hood. And it's just a forward, you know, it's just a forward moving game. You know, it's sort of like you have to, she's constantly moving forward. You just have to make sure that she doesn't die, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it goes through, okay, I'm going to spoil Lucidity for you. Even though it's kind of obvious, it's about a girl reconciling the death of her grandmother. And as the game goes along, it starts out bright and cheerful, and then it just keeps getting darker and darker and darker as she's going through the Kubler stages of grief, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you ever, even out of context, the ending is so beautiful, in which she sees her grandmother getting on the Afterlife Express, you know, and bidding her goodbye. I strongly suggest going to YouTube and checking out the ending of Lucidity. But that's basically what this reminded me of in terms of story beats.
Yeah, I can see that.
Anyways, we're going to move on to the next game. And that would be Scott. Scott okay. loves... Here's a question, Scott. How did you find someone to play with you?
I didn't. I watched a Let's Play, and it was two friends playing the game.
Well, so people know, we're talking about A Way Out, and yes, this is a game that requires co-op. You cannot play it single player.
You have to play with a friend or you know, somebody that you trust to communicate with and be in sync when you're doing the actions. So there's a lot of stuff where you have to work together and work together well to get past various obstacles, like climbing up a wall back to back, or using a picking someone up and getting them up a tall wall, and they pick you up, and you know, there's like lots of different things. And again, you're both playing at the same time, and there's a lot of action sequences, and you play about 95% of the game like this. Where you're
and the last 5% is, oh, guess what?
Yeah.
Now it's just you versus me, babe. Spoiler, yeah. At the end they fight each other.
So, oh, my God.
Yeah, after that long journey of working together, you get this twist where you find out the other guy is actually, you know, a cop, and you're the criminal, and he has to arrest you now, and you're just, like, outraged, so you're going to go kill him, and he's trying to bring you in, so he has to kill you, and you get two different endings with
the
case.
It's Kane and Lynch level of depression. It's Kane and Lynch level of depressing.
I guess it could be depressing, but it was like such a twist to see that, you know, you have this game where, again, you're spending all this time with this person, learning to work together, and then at the last minute, it's all of a sudden, it's you or him, and you have to fight, and it's a fight to the death, and and the game has two different endings depending on who wins, and it's it can be very sad because, you know, you liked that other person, you just, there was just no way out, you, this was your choice, and
well, there is a way out. That's the name of the game.
Like, right, one of those moments.
By the way, I think that might be a spoiler title. It's not ways out. No, it's a way out. Guess what? There's only one way out.
Right.
But here's the thing, is that it is kind of daring, especially for a major publisher, to release a game that says, no, you can't play by yourself. You have to have someone else play with you.
Sure. Yeah. I got to say, maybe one of my favorite soundtracks of 2018. They did a really good job with the score in that game. Like, I usually don't care too much about it. Like, I love fighting game themes, but like for me to actually go to listen to a soundtrack to a game like this outside of it says a lot for the game for me. I thought that they did a really good job with the music in here, and like the fucking last song in the game is heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
Like the whole scene is heart wrenching, no matter who makes it out, and
the controller shakes as you're doing that last action. You know, like it's like, are you sure you want to do this? And it's,
oh,
it's,
no, you have to. It's not a choice that you have in the game.
Yeah, that sucks. It's not a choice for me.
Yeah.
I get it, but at the same time, I was mad that it wasn't a choice. There should have been four endings. Should have been two endings where you don't shoot the other guy.
Yeah, that was nice.
Okay.
But we do what we can with what we have.
That sort of sounds like you saying, well, I should have had the choice not to use the phosphorus. No, fuck you. No, that wasn't your choice. You had to use the phosphorus in the game. Sorry.
I know. But
people know what I'm referring to.
I'm not saying, you know what, your game is bad and you should remake it. I'm saying your game made me feel so much that I was mad at it.
I loved the ending of Prince of Persia 2008. I just loved it to death. That was such a great ending. And I don't care if people say, well, I'm doing everything that I worked for. No, fuck you. This is how the character would act in this situation and deal with it. If you didn't really want him to do it, then just shut off the game. Actually, you know, that's exactly what the Stanley Principle says. You know, one of the endings in which you're stuck in that thing in which you're going to die and there's nothing you can do to stop it. You know what the developer says? And actually the woman narrator says, turn off the game. Just turn it off. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't like the ending of Way Out, just stop. You won't get the achievement, but just pretend, oh, they held hands and they went through a field of bunnies and flowers and everything was okay, and, you know. Anyways, we're going to now talk about a game that I loved and hated. That's Forza Horizon 4. And, you know, one of the things about this game is that, you know what the biggest oh shit thing about it was? It knew my name. It said, hello, Jonah. And then, what the fuck? Wait, what? It's calling me by my name?
Did you have to enter that somewhere?
No.
What was the deal?
That's the entire point. And if I didn't have a screen name that had my name in it, it would still said my name. That's kind of disturbing because it means it's going into my billing files and seeing my name. But still, it was like, fuck. It knows my name. It can see me. I you know.
Oh, no.
I don't have a Kinect, so it can't see me, but still. I miss my Kinect. Anyways, but it's like, oh, my God. It kept on during the entire game. It kept on calling me by my name. Jonah. Hey, Jonah. Stop saying my name. It's creepy. So here's the thing. I love Forza, but I've never loved the Horizon series because I'm not into off-road and I'm not into open world and all that stuff. Call me boring, I like Forza Motorsport. But I will say that Forza Horizon 4 made me enjoy it much more than I thought I would.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the races were ass anyway, but it just, you know what it does? It gives you that feedback. Every time you level up, it gives you shit, you know? I could buy the most expensive car, like 3 hours in if I wanted to. And that's a mistake, by the way, because if you get the best car and then you soup it up, then it's all of a sudden S9999 or X999, I don't remember which. Which means you're not going to be able to... The car's going to be hard to control because it's just too slick. And B, you're going to be facing all these A-level characters, you know, because the race is, you know, level with you. So if I'm riding with a shitty car, other shitty cars will race with me. So, but yeah, I mean, Forza Horizon 4, there's a reason why it was the second best game on the Xbox One, according to Metacritic. And I agree. It's just not my game, but at least it was good enough that I could recognize it for, you know, I'll wait for Forza Horizon 8. That's basically it. I'll just wait for the next Motorsport. I mean, Forza Motorsport. I'll wait for the next Motorsport game.
Sure.
So let's talk about Moss, TJ.
Moss was maybe one of my favorite VR games of the year, and I say that in front of Tetris Effect. I like Tetris Effect a lot, but I liked Moss better. It did a thing that I've always theorized would be really fun with a VR game of its sort, and that's taking the VR perspective and not putting it next to the character or anywhere near them, but putting it overhead like a Zelda game and allowing you to look around the environment as you move the character around in it.
Can't believe you. I mean, you've gone through the entire introduction to this game and not mentioned the main character once and what it is. Seriously.
And by the way, you play as an adorable little anthropomorphic mouse with a little blade of grass that she uses as a sword.
Yep. That is adorable as hell.
So yeah, it's really a fun little adventure with a character. Like, you know what? Tunic is leaving money on the table by not putting their game in VR. I probably get why they won't, but at the same time, it's something that Moss proved works. And, I mean, you have an adorable little anthropomorphic character and a Tunic.
Tunic. Don't worry about Tunic. We're playing that game.
But Moss was great. Moss took a theory that I've always thought would be great for a game for a long time, and they proved that it can work.
That's an adorable game. I need to play it, too.
Actually, that reminds me. There's a game we're not mentioning, and that's Ghost of a Tale, which is another game about a mouse. And have you heard of Ghost of the Tail? Ghost of the Tail?
I have not. I'm
it's
looking at it.
It's a little game in which you play a little mouse, and it's basically you're in the middle of Nazis or something like that. You know, it's in a big rat fantasy castle. So in the beginning, it's basically good guys, bad guys. Mice, good guys. Rats, bad guys.
Oh, my God. It looks like a red wall cover.
But here's the thing about it is that as you play the game, you start to realize, well, actually, all the mice are sneaky thieves, and they're not that great. And the rats may be, what's it called, maybe oppressive, but they also aren't sneaky thievey things, you know? And it's sort of like plays to the expectations. So, yeah, I mean, and then we had another game, which we're going to be discussing later, Vermintide 2. So, basically, this was the year of the rat.
This does look like somebody took the Redwall series and made a game about it. Wow. And that is so cool. I'll have to play this. I'll have to put this on my list.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, Ghost of a Tail is very interesting. It's a stealth game, too. And there are very few true stealth games. At least Ghost of a Tail is really a stealth game. So now Scott didn't list any other things. Just me and TJ are going to go back and forth for a bit. I had another game which I loved, and that's State of Decay 2. And I would have loved it if not for the fucking bugs.
Yeah, that game was bogged down so badly by it could have been so much more, and it just
here's the thing. I was really getting into it. I did not get as much into the first State of Decay as I was getting into State of Decay 2. But the fucking bugs just made it impossible to play.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to be bold here. State of Decay 2 was your Fallout 76 for a lot of other people.
The problem with Fallout 76 was a big empty world that was dull.
By a lot of accounts, I've heard people say that they've had wonderful experiences with, and I'm not even talking about multiplayer experiences. I've heard people say
Either, and that's one of the things I did want to try with State of Decay before, you know, but the bugs.
Yeah. And I've heard people say this thing that you're saying about State of Decay 2, about Fallout 76, of what it could have been if it wasn't so bogged down with its problems.
Here's the thing. I'm not going to say it's like Fallout 76. I'm going to say it's like No Man's Sky. Because No Man's Sky, at least they worked on and they improved and they made it work. If I come back to State of Decay 2 a year later, I'm going to assume that it's going to be nice and clean and bug-free.
Yeah. But I feel like we've made that comparison of No Man's Sky to Fallout 76 at some point too, because No Man's Sky was a game that
was
just
basically irretrievable.
Empty.
I mean, Fallout 76. The problems with Fallout 76 have very little to do with the bugs, and it has everything to do with design. Now, No Man's Sky also, most of what was wrong with it was not bugs; it was design. But they were able to improve it. I don't know how they're going to improve Fallout 76. To tell you the truth, I don't know if they can improve it. They just decided to release Fallout 4, take out all the NPCs, okay, have fun in this open world doing jack and shit.
Sure.
And finding the secrets. Big whoop. Oh, we found nuke codes, and that's the only reason to play, I think. Anyways, let's talk about the game that's most inexplicably loved by everyone, simply because, you know, I'm sorry, I cannot fucking stand Smash Brothers. I don't care if, you know... I'm not a fan of, oh, I recognize that character.
Yeah, but I am. And not just the fact that I recognize a lot of the stuff and it gives me a warm fuzzy inside every time I see it.
You are a fighting game professional and you're playing Smash Brothers. So.
Yes, because ultimately I found it works the same as Blaze Blue Cross Tag does for me. I found a character that I enjoy playing and I just play the shit out of him until I'm good at him.
Here's the thing. There's a game that is about a billion times better than Smash Brothers.
You're about to say Brawlhalla, and I've given it a try.
No. No.
Not Brawlhalla?
No. Duck Game. Duck Game is a million times better because A, it has character. B, it has great maps and it has great design.
Duck Game is different, though.
No, it isn't. It's Smash Brothers, except interesting. And funny.
I wouldn't say that. It feels more like if you took, the sort of Rumble Melee style
It has much more sense of humor, because every so often you'll get this one thing in which you're just four ducks in a small, tiny little room. And it's like, okay, everybody shoot. That's all we can do in this room.
Duck Game is kind of like if you took that sort of Brawl style and put the weapons from Worms in it.
Yeah, but like I said, it has much more style and humor and interest. Here's the thing. The other thing is
Dick
that
Spider,
you know,
is the one I like.
But here's the thing about it about Smash Brothers also is that a lot of it is just a mass of bodies flying around. You really can't see what's going on if you're just watching it. Duck Game is a great game to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I spent hours in
E3 over the past few years just plopping my keister down and watching people play Duck Game.
Yeah, but people have spent years watching Smash Bros. Played at the professional level at fighting game tournaments the point where Smash Bros. Melee, a game that it was on the GameCube, had the most tournament entries at EVO of any game there outside of Street Fighter V.
Anybody could play it. God damn it.
It's sure, but that's the thing is that it makes for a, it make oh, the fact that anyone can play
you're
it.
You're a fucking
only,
mad man. No,
but listen, listen. Anyone can play it, but the same eight people always make the top eight in there, and you can't tell me that that doesn't mean certain levels of skill don't exist in that game.
I'm not talking about skill. I'm talking about interesting. It's just not interesting.
People would disagree
it's
with you.
It's just a cloud of if you're playing, it's fun, I guess. But if you're watching, it's not fun.
It's one of those games where it's super simplistic. It's super, like, it's not going to win any awards for being intricate.
It
but at the
win.
Same time.
It did win awards because people are stupid.
But no, because there is a ceiling to it that there that people that put a lot of time into it can reach.
Okay, you can keep drumming that being that drum all you like. I'm not gonna.
I don't. I'm not even drumming it alone because there's people like Mewtwo King and Zero and Mango that'll do it for me because they're professional players of that game.
Okay, can we just stop for a moment?
I
just want to stop for a moment because you're reminding me. Let's of the Game Awards, everything was eh, but I will say, you know, let's talk about the best part of the Game Awards, and that was Sonic 5000 winning, or Sonic Fox.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about Sonic Fox, at least someone who's interesting.
Now, hold on. Before we get away from that, I will say that Smash Bros. Ultimate has something that's also fun for me, who's not a professional player of that game. Uh-huh. And that's the fact that even though it is rehashed material from just like years and years and years of Nintendo history, it's there is some love put into it. Like putting these stages together, putting these nods in the game, like putting some of the remixed music in
there.
Yeah,
but now you're just talking about, oh, I recognize that.
No, I'm talking about things from the past revisited and re-put together and reimagined for a game in 2018. There's like there's a Metroid remix of a game that of a song that came out on the original Metroid in 1987, and like it's a new song that they put together just for this game. And hearing those tunes in a different format and hearing that somebody composed this just gives me the warm fuzzies because it's a song that I loved from my childhood. Put okay. together in a new way,
that's
and
fine.
That's
let's talk about Sonic and, Fox instead.
No, I'm going to say that is my feeling about all of Smash Bros. Ultimate. It's a bunch of things that everybody loves put together in a new way that's really fuzzy.
Okay, Sonic Fox. So he was the best part of the Game Awards, and we're talking about an esports fighter. I would never have pegged him for a Mortal Kombat player, tell you the truth. But that's his specialty. He's won mm-hmm. 4 EVOs. For those who don't know, EVO is the biggest fighting game event. And, you know, he's openly gay and he's openly a furry. And I love the way he pissed people off by saying that in his acceptance speech. I'm black, I'm a furry, and I'm gay. Everybody, all the Republicans hate me.
Yeah, and he doubles down and it's so hard, too.
Yeah.
It's really funny. Because the current trend with people yelling at Sonic Fox is that they keep thinking that that's all he ever says is I'm gay, which is clearly wrong. I follow the dude and have followed the dude for a while.
Well,
and
he's kind of hard to miss because he actually wears that fursuit at some events at Evo.
The really funny thing about those people that just go out there and scream, I wish Sonic Fox would stop saying I'm gay because he says it all the time. Are definitely people that are searching Sonic Fox I'm gay and getting really mad at just like that's the search results it gives back to them.
Yeah.
Because that dude posts combo videos and tech videos all the time and nobody ever complains about that shit.
Yeah. I mean, listen, he's been – for those who don't know, he's been a professional player since 2011. Now, he's 20 years old, so you can use math there. He's been playing since he was 12.
Mm-hmm.
Or actually 13.
The thing that people hate about Sonic Fox is that he's also a professional shit talker and does not back down.
And it's kind of hard to take when he's wearing that blue suit and he's shit talking.
Yeah. Like he'll talk shit to you, but he'll also back it up and win. So
here's the thing. Here's the thing I learned. He actually lives near me. He lives mm-hmm. very near me. He goes to NYIT, which is not very far away from me.
Yeah.
So
before that, he was living in the Philadelphia area, so he's always been up there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't go to Philly that much, but I'm saying he lives in New York now, so. But yeah, I mean, by the way, his real name is Dominique McLean? Mm-hmm. Here's the thing. The actor who played in MASH, his name was I think he pronounced his name McLean. McLean? No, they pronounce his name McLean. So I'm interested, but I don't. It could be McLean.
His name is pronounced Sonic Fox.
Okay, Sonic Fox. His Twitter is Sonic Fox 5000 for those who want to speak to him. Anyway,
but no, like he's a really good dude, and it couldn't have happened to a better guy. Like the guy is a positive influence, and like he's not ashamed of what he is, and will not take will not accept people telling him he should be ashamed for what he is.
Okay. So the next game is one that's not a cheat, but it is sort of a cheat because it's Mark of the Ninja Remastered. It was released, and if you owned Mark of the Ninja, you got it for free, which is cool. And I will say this, it is the best stealth game this side of Thief. And it makes you feel powerful. And you can play it any way. You could do it so you're always sneak and ghosting it and they never know you're there. Or you can play it as sneaky and brutalize people and just make them shit their pants, seeing their friends discombobulated and all this stuff, you know, hanging from the ceiling and all that stuff. So you're sort of like a violent Batman. Or you can just be a regular ninja and just, you know, sword goodbye and, you know, hide the body. You know, that sort of thing. I mean, any way you want to play it, you can play it. You know, you can play nasty, you can play ghost, you can play ninja, whatever. And it is one of the best looking games. We're talking about, you know, Gris and all that stuff. You know, this game never stops feeling like an animated cartoon. And it's from 2013, I think? I'm not sure. But I'm going to say right now, if you haven't played Mark of the Ninja, play it. Play it, play it, play it.
It's always the most perplexing thing in the world to me that the same people who did Mark of the Ninja and Shank also did Don't Starve.
Oh, yeah. Clay Entertainment.
They're so good at changing up their styles.
There are two people I'll always two developers I always trust no matter what they do. One is Clay, the other is Monolith.
Mm-hmm. They also have Grifflands. Yep. Which is like sort of
and a they have a game coming list. Out. Oh no, that is the game that's coming out, Grifflands, which looks really interesting.
Yes, it's a steampunk sort of wasteland RPG.
So basically, the outer worlds, except by them.
Mm-hmm. Which I mean, it looks fun. It just in the same way that Mark of the Ninja looks so different from Don't Starve, Grifflands looks completely different from both of the other two. It's really cool to see how Clay changes up their styles every time they make a game.
Yeah. So finally, of the games that we actually picked, you went with another reboot as well. It's not a remake though, is it?
Monster Boy and the Cursed Kingdom is not a reboot.
It's just an extension. I mean, here's the thing. Monster Boy was a game for a long time, and apparently, you know, actually, Monster Boy was made by the same creator as Wonder Boy. I think that's where I'm getting confused.
Yes.
But the question is, was Monster Boy Wonder Boy?
Or Monster
two
Boy
different characters.
Basically, what happened is the one company got the rights to it. Another company was making a game on it. The one company shut the other company down, and they had to make different games.
Right.
Monster Boy is the one that had to change. Wonder Boy and the Dragon's Trap was the remake.
Right.
But that said, Monster Boy is really.
I gotcha. You almost called him Wonder Boy.
Monster Boy is really fun though. Atelier is the developer. They did a good job on this one. It's a straight up like.
Well, it was made by the same guy who did Monster Boy and Wonder Boy and Monster World.
Uh huh. So basically, the original creator of Wonder Boy lost the rights to his own thing.
Nishizawa.
He lost the rights to his creation. And so he couldn't make Wonder Boy because somebody else owns the rights to it, basically.
And it sat on those rights too. I don't think anything from Wonder Boy has come out.
They just made like a remake of Wonder Boy and the Dragon's
That's
Trap.
Not the same
which...
thing. That's not the same thing. That's not the same thing. Just remaking something is not the same thing.
No, they like because that was a pixelated game and basically they
yeah I know but remastering the same game. I mean actually making a new game. That's what I'm talking about.
Sure, but what I'm saying is that Monster Boy is its own is sort of its own thing. It has a lot of the similar qualities that Wonder Boy has, where you can change into all sorts of different forms.
Like a pig with an eye patch.
Mm-hmm. Who's all punchy and can throw boomerangs and fart.
Well, here's the thing. Actually, this has something that the original Wonder Boy didn't have, and that's charm. I mean, but that's, again, that's, well, here's the thing. You know, Wonder Boy always looked generic to me, you know. With the now, we're talking about graphics now, and the graphics we can do now, now you can actually have a lot of charm, you know.
And, oh, my God. Monster Boy in the Chris Kingdom is so vibrant. Everything, it looks like a cartoon, and like a really bright cartoon.
It looks like a cartoon from the 80s, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. You know? And we were talking about this before, Scott, you know, talking about, you know, how bright and colorful, you know, Dragon Quest XI was. This has the same thing, in which they, you know, you have reds and golds and greens and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and this was another one that came out at the end of the year. It came out right around the same time as Gris and fell under a lot of people's radar. But it was actually in the works for quite a while. Like, I remember playing this at PAX South 2017. And it's...
Summer games just screen people up with their Game of the Year awards.
And I wouldn't say that this is the best game I've ever played, but I will say that it was a great cap on 2018. It was my game that, like, when I didn't feel like playing something that required a lot of mental effort, like Blaze Blue, or if I didn't feel like getting into a deep narrative like Horizon, I would sit down and play Monster Boy, and I just sort of let my cares float away as I just get enraptured in that game's catchy music and colorful platforming.
All right. So let's talk about games we did not discuss that none of us picked. Now, the first game is Celeste, and this was a game that won the Best Indie Game and was just released on Xbox Gold Pass. So I have it. I haven't played it yet. Think of Spelunky mixed with N. Or not N, but what's the other game that's sort of like... Oh, Super Meat Boy, basically.
Yeah, it really is. It really does have that feel of Super Meat Boy with a story.
It has a very interesting story. I saw a Let's Play of it, and you have a female protagonist, and you're climbing up a mountain. I forget why you're climbing up. I think you're...
Because it's there, damn it.
Mm-hmm. It's there, yeah.
That's a joke.
That's usually the reason, because it's there. And you're going up a mountain. You have these abilities to jump along the walls, and
yeah.
I think you like have a second air jump. And then there's a point where I guess you find an evil clone, or there's a spirit that imitates you, and so it starts chasing you, and now you have to go through these puzzles at a very quick pace because something's trying to kill you, and it looks like a very crazy, intense game. So I haven't played it, but it looks really good.
Well, if you had... Well, it's too late now. I don't think it's still on Xbox Gold Pass right now, but it was free for people who had it. Came out way back in February, too.
Mm-hmm. It's one of those games that I might watch, but I'll never play myself, just because I don't have the patience for that much trial and error platforming.
Oh, yeah. But here's the thing, you know, so long as when you die, you immediately resurrect, that's fine. I mean, that's, I wouldn't say Mark of the Ninja is trial and error, but it's more like, if you fuck up, don't worry about it, just go back to the last checkpoint. And they always have the perfect checkpoints in Mark of the Ninja, too, so, you know, it allows you to be more daring.
Yeah. And it's cute. It has a good soundtrack as well, and it's I like the way they did it, but yeah. It's just one of those games where I feel like it would frustrate me too much to go to the end.
Yeah, so, it looks very stressful and very intense.
I would rather watch somebody else do it.
Yeah, same here.
So Warhammer Vermintide 2, and the only thing about that is it makes me wish they would fucking come out with Left 4 Dead 3 already. Here's the thing I discovered about this type of game. Melee sucks. It's good enough in Left 4 Dead when you're pushing back the zombies, but really, that sort of game needs guns. At least to me. I mean, a lot of people liked Vermintide. I liked Vermintide. Vermintide 2, it didn't quite feel the same. You know, I don't know. I mean, Vermintide 2, hey, look, if you need a co-op, four-player co-op game against rats instead of zombies, it's fine.
Okay.
Zombies. Far Cry 5, one of the most meh games of the year. It is the perfect Ubisoft open world game. It is everything that's good and bad about Ubisoft open world.
Man, I just can't work up any sort of feeling for the Far Cry games. It's not that they're
bad. Whoa, wait a minute. What about New Dawn? Which basically spoils the ending of Far Cry 5.
I just can't. I have nothing.
Let me ask you a question. When you see Far Cry New Dawn, you know what pops in my head? It looks like Rage 2. It looks like Rage 2. It looks like Rage 2 and Blood Dragon had a baby.
It absolutely does look like that. And it looks like they completely saw Rage 2 and were like, we should do what they got going on there. We put off a nuke. Let's just make a Rage 2.
Yeah, by the way, for those of you who don't know, at the end of Far Cry 5, yep, end of the world, and now it's Mad Max. But the thing is, the reason why I say Blood Dragon is because there's a slight hint of Far Cry Blood Dragon aesthetic in it, too. I don't know, you know, I guess it's the pinks and purples. Anyways. Jurassic World Evolution. Yeah, it's Zoo Tycoon, except with dinosaurs.
God, I heard so many good things about this from some of my friends, and it's one of those things where it probably would be on my Game of the Year list if I played it.
It's okay. The problem with it is that you have three factions in the zoo, and all of them want you to do the same thing just for different reasons. It's like, why not have us have to make a choice, meaningful choice between the three?
Sure, you know? But like once you get down to like just straight up free play, learning the dinosaurs' behaviors, I've heard, is like one of the funnest parts about it because they will break out on a regular basis.
They always break out, no matter how much. That's why you need the fucking security van with people with trank darts.
And so, like, it is one of those things that we've talked about, like, where you don't do it right the first time. You fail and you get better.
Yeah.
So this is one of those things where I'm probably going to pick it up at some point in 2019.
It's one of those games you'll find in the rack, you know, in the discount rack.
Yeah, I'll explore it eventually, but, like, not until it's dropped down to a little bit of a discounted price.
One of the games that went under the radar was Barstail 4.
I didn't even know it came out.
And I haven't played it yet. I need to play that. I haven't played it yet, but it did come out, and it got a whole bunch of patches. So sometime this year I'll play it and let you know.
It's actually a hack and slash game, which shocked me, because that's not what...
It's turn-based.
Is it?
It's turn-based.
Okay. Because, I guess I'm... Maybe I was thinking about a different game. But, yeah, I mean, it's one of the games by InXile, and, you know, it's one of the games by Brian Fargo, but it's sort of like it just came and went without anybody noticing.
People noticed. Maybe you didn't.
No, it had no buzz. It had no buzz.
Like I said, I knew of its existence, but I had no idea it actually had come out.
I knew it was on Go. I was thinking about backing it, but I decided not to. I mean, sorry.
It's a turn-based strategy game where you're placing your characters and fighting the enemy.
It's Barstail.
It's Barstail. But they added a mechanic where you get certain magical items, and if there's a puzzle on the item, if you can unlock its abilities by, you know, fiddling with the weapon or whatever to, you know, figure out how it needs to be set to do its greater abilities.
No. Star Control Origins, poor Star Control Origins, poor. You know, here's the thing. I was talking before about funny games, and Star Control is a funny game. It has a great, Doctor Who sense of humor. And its gameplay is surprisingly simple. I mean, you're a ship, you just shoot. It's like a directional shooter. But you have to get the right sort of weapons, you have to get the right sort of ship, or else you're fucked. And one of the problems of the game is that it doesn't really hint what kind of ship you need. Because there's some things that are going to be impossible without a certain type of ship. And, oh, by the way, you picked the wrong ship? Well, fuck you, you lose.
Mm-hmm.
But, like I said, it's a pity that you can't buy it now until they figure out what to do about the rights. It's just weird. But, on the other hand, no one's going to cry a tear about not being able to get Star Control Origins. It's a very niche game, a very funny game, but still, you know, no one's going to cry, oh, no, I can't play Star Control Origins. Except for people who can't buy it. Now they're upset they can't get it. If this hadn't happened, they would never even wanted to get it. Now they want it because they can't have it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the games that is a big game that just went under everybody's radar, too, is Valkyria Chronicles 4. I mean, people were raving about it before it came out, and it came out, and nothing was said about it. It's weird.
Yeah, this is another one of those things where, like, I was aware of it, but I don't know if anyone that's... It's like Gwent.
People
I
were
haven't
excited
heard.
About it. They were fucking excited. And it's like, okay.
I haven't heard a single thing about it, whether it's good or bad.
It's good. It's very, very, very good, which is why I'm shocked that no one talks about it.
Yeah, especially the people that love the original trilogy. Because, like, there are people out there that absolutely love the original trilogy and will go to bat for it all day long.
Yeah. Of course, we have Assassin's Creed Odyssey, another Ubisoft open world game. And this, you know, actually, I can't say it broke me because Assassin's Creed broke me, but it's sort of like the series is dead in the water. I mean, here's the thing. Ever since Miles killed her, oh, fuck, I forgot her name. I was talking about her earlier today. When Desmond Miles killed Lucy, you know, it's sort of like the game just went, oh, I don't care anymore. Assassin's Creed is only interesting to me because of Miles Desmond. What could I say? Or Desmond Miles.
Yeah. I mean, I've only ever really seriously put time into one Assassin's Creed game, and that was, I think, Revelations.
Oh, I put all my time into the two Assassin's Creed 2 games. Then I got to Assassin's Creed 3 and was like, oh, this could have been fun, but it's not. And I was perked up by Black Flag, but even then, you know, I just wanted to stay on the boat. I didn't want to get off the boat.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Yet another game that was heavily hyped, but no one said really anything about, and I actually did play, was Soul Calibur 6. I will say it's Soul Calibur-y. It's so Soul Calibur-y, it's Soul Calibur's the Soul Calibur.
There was a lot of fighting games that came out in a short area of time, and I just did not have time to dedicate myself to all of them.
Here's the problem with Soul Calibur 6, though. The controls feel janky. It does not – you do not – when you play a game like Injustice 2 or your Arc System works, when you do combos and all that stuff, it feels like you're actually doing it. And there's something slippery about Soul Calibur 6.
Soul Calibur 6 is loose with its movement to the point where it feels almost cheap.
It does feel cheap. That you know, the game feels cheap. It feels like a single – it feels like a double-A game when it's actually a triple-A game, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and it's just the fact that they stressed movement in there. They stressed movement so hard that it's very free-flowing. It's very...
I don't care. You know, if I wanted to play fucking Virtua Fighter, I'd play Virtua Fighter. I don't want to play Virtua Fighter.
Yeah, but a lot of people want to play Virtua Fighter.
Apparently
so...
not, since sales tanked on Soul Calibur 6.
Did so, they?
Yeah. Huh. So... Yeah, I don't care. Darksiders 3, actually, they made a Darksiders game that worked. Yeah, the characters are bullshit, and the story is bullshit, and it doesn't even have good continuity. But hey, you know, here's the thing. It is easy. If you want any sort of challenge, you have to jack it up to the hardest challenge of all.
That's a shame.
But no, I mean, it's a good game, though. It's a pretty game. It's basically what people were waiting for with Darksiders. You know, this game is trying to be a little bit like Dark Souls, but, you know, it's fine. It's fine. And finally, the game that wants to be Batman Arkham Asylum, Marvel Spider-Man.
No, it wants to be Spider-Man. It just pulls things from
Batman. It wants to be Batman. It does everything that Batman does. It is so Batman-y, it's Batman. But Spider-Man. And, you know, you can't blame it. I mean, look, it worked with Batman. It worked with Middle-Earth, you know.
Well, I mean, if you're going to do a Spider-Man, you've got to do, like, the being able to travel around the city because that's the spectacle.
Yeah, I mean, well, here's the thing. It's still not better than Amazing Spider-Man 2. Period.
Bold.
What?
Bold.
What do you mean?
I don't think that's true. I think it is better than
Amazing Spider-Man 2. No, I mean... Amazing Spider-Man 2 actually made you feel like you were web-slinging. You know, that was part of the game itself, in fact. This, it feels like you're Batman, and I'm shocked they didn't have a grappling hook.
I mean, no. Except for web fluid. You still have, yeah. You still have the things that make Spider-Man Spider-Man, all the acrobatics, all the flipping around and all that jazz. And I mean, like, maybe that's just the fact that...
I will say it was a better story than Homecoming.
I'm going to go out there and say that, like, maybe it's just the fact that Spider-Man and Batman are a little similar in certain ways.
I have both.
A little too similar in certain ways.
I have both Batman and Spider-Man crossovers. One is a smart mouth joking guy.
No. Not personality or theme or.
No, I'm saying about combat all the time.
I'm talking about like their style of combat.
But here's the thing. I have both Batman Spider-Man crossovers, and they meld really well together. Those two characters are made for each other, because as you said, one is the dour. Well, he doesn't have to be dour, but you know, he doesn't talk much. You know, he's sort of serious. Spider-Man is chatty and all that stuff, and they work too well together. You know, it's sort of like Batman and Robin tends to be the chatty one. You know,
they are both vigilantes. That is true.
I didn't mean to like cut you off that way and be rude about it. I meant in the way that they're both sort of their entire style of combat and traversal is entirely acrobatic and gadget based.
Now imagine a Robin Spider-Man game. Anyways,
yeah,
those are the games. You know, there's a ton of shit games. We're not going to talk about them. We're just going to talk about the games that were interesting, you know, that we found interesting. Let us know what your best game of 2018 was, and if we forgot something. I mean, probably did. You know, there's probably a lot of games out there. I mean, I didn't mention Out of the Park Baseball 18 because no one cares about a baseball tech sim. You know, that's always, and it's kind of boring because it's basically the same great game every year after year after year. So I think it's like a cheat for me.
I think I almost put Owlboy on the Nintendo Switch on my Game of the Year list.
I was tempted to leave Owlboy. There were some games that came out on the Switch that came for the first time. There was another game, and I forgot the name of it. It has a strange name. It begins with an O. That it's an indie game that everybody's been raving about, and it's like, okay.
What kind of game is it?
I forgot.
I mean, there's Onrush, which was the arcade racer that ended up not being... It was supposed to be like Blur, but it just didn't live up to the hype, or Burnout.
No, actually, I can find out in a second.
Outlast?
No. Damn it, where's this... Let's see.
Obra Dinn?
Yeah, I think that was it. Obra Dinn.
Return of the Obra Dinn.
Yeah, that's the game that's been talked about a ton.
I hear people say things about this, a lot. And I haven't jumped into it yet, but it sounds interesting.
Yeah, I mean, Return of the Obra Dinn has been pimped out by everybody. You know, came out in October. And, yeah, I mean, it's... I mean, a lot of people like it because, you know, you're doing investigations and you're, you know, that sort of
thing. It's very stylized, too. It does look like it looks like...
It's a logic puzzle game. I mean,
uh-huh. No, I'm talking about, like, the
visual aspect of it. Yeah, it has a very stark look to it, yeah. But, yeah, Return of the Obra Dinn, it's only on Mac and Windows, so... And it was designed by Lucas Pope.
Mm-hmm.
For those who don't know, Lucas Pope is the guy behind Papers, Please.
Yes.
So, I mean, I wonder if he was the only person to develop... Because here's the thing, Papers, Please, I think, was only him and only him. I think that was a one-man... I wonder if this was a one-man develop game as well.
I mean, it straight up just says Lucas Pope under developer when you look at it on Steam. So, probably.
Yeah. I mean, it's meant to look like a Mac game, just so you know, if people know. It's meant to look like one of those Mac games from the original Mac, which is basically stark black and white, you know, and has a certain look to it. So, yeah. Anyway, I plan to look at it. I mean, it won Best Art Direction at the Game Awards.
Uh-huh.
It was nominee for Best Independent Game. Anyways, if you think we've forgotten any games, let us know. I've just botched up there. Look for our show notes at gamingpodcast.net, along with industry news and our gaming history articles. We enjoy feedback, so leave us comments at our blog at gamingpodcast.net. Also, hit us up at facebook.com/gamingpodcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us on iTunes comments, and you can find me at Twitter at Jonah Falcon.
You can find me at Johnny Chokes.
And I'm at Alpha Shard.
And, first episode of the year. Belated, but, you know, we're going to start doing our weekly thing now that I'm all settled in.
Cool.
And next week, I promise we'll have some news. And it might be, we might include some old news if it remains relevant, because there's some big shit that's been going on in the beginning of the year, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just like, I've been posting links to them, and it's sort of like, wow, this is happening.
Yes, there. I'm interested to see what you pick out of the bunch.
Well, I'm probably definitely going to talk about Bungie and split away from Activision.
That was...
Here's the thing about that, and we're going to remain just for a few seconds. Bungie is now going to work on Destiny by themselves. And we already know that the first Destiny was hacked and slashed by Activision so much to make him... I think it's too late to actually fix that game. It's way too late.
We'll do a
Destiny 3 and just start from scratch.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, they retained the rights to it for a reason, and I have to imagine that they'll at least give it their best shot at making it a little bit different.
I had this funny thought of Microsoft saying, so, you want to come back and bring Destiny with you?
That's what a lot of people have said, and I can sort of see it happening, because
I don't think that'll happen, but it would be funny.
Mm-hmm.
Because if Microsoft took Bungie back there and say, hey, you see that thing over there, the four-letter word net game that you started so many years ago? Fix that. Or maybe they'll merge the two universes. Because they are in the same universe if you played Halo 3 ODST.
Mm-hmm.
We will see you next week talking about Bungie and Activision and that kind of stuff.
Happy gaming, everyone.
Have fun. Take care. Play games, y'all.